the Download, the founder of Make It Better Media, Susan B. Noyes, chef and owner of Small's Barbecue, Joaquin Soler, and live music in Studio 435 with Chicago rapper Show You Suck. And now, here's your host, a man who forgot how long the Pride Parade route was, Justin Kaufman.
I see. So you get to Belmont and Halstead, and you're like, oh, great. It's, oh, my gosh. There's six more miles to this thing. I feel like I need ice. Like, my lower back right now is... Getting too old, Pete. That's the problem. Getting too old to walk. You know, there's something to be said, you know, at a certain point. I mean, I do 4 hours a night here on WGN. Maybe I can get, like, maybe I could sit in the truck, you know, maybe, or maybe around the van. I'm not saying I deserve a float spot. I understand where I'm at in the pecking order, but maybe. No, it was fun. It was a lot of fun to be out there at the Pride Parade yesterday with all the WGN family. Great afternoon. What weather. Amazing. Good stuff. I hope that parade, you know, because there's always after the parade happens, there's always people are like, oh, it's too congested. The parties afterwards are too much. Next year, it's definitely going to be downtown. You know, you hear that it'll come out from different officials and business leaders, things like that. I hope that never happens because, frankly, to be a part of that from the vantage point of actually being in the parade and seeing how it snakes through Chicago is pretty tremendous. I don't know what rivals it when it comes to parades. Chicago's got a great history of certain ethnic parades in Chicago neighborhoods. Keep it that way.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
I made a tactical error in that I kind of veered off to go to the bathroom. And I veered off in the middle of a protest. So I was in, like, I was kind of like in The Fugitive. I was kind of wheeling my way through the protest, but also saying, like, no, I'm not with these guys.
I'm not with these guys. What kind of protest was it?
I don't even know.
There was just, like, right in front of us, we talked to Roe. There was two or three floats in front just kind of stopped with some protests. It wasn't a big deal. And I don't even think it was anti-gay. Like, I don't think it was an anti-gay protest. I think it was maybe a Black Lives Matter type protest. I don't know what it was, but they had snuck onto the route and then quickly were taken off. But anyway, great time yesterday. WGN Radio had a blast out at the Pride Parade. Always a pleasure to be there and to participate. Justin Kaufman here. It's a Download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200. We got a great show lined up. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy have nothing to argue about tonight. There's just nothing. I was looking through stuff. I'm like, Russia investigation? Nah, everyone agrees on that. Healthcare? I mean, come on. It's 100%. Travel ban? Supreme Court? Come on. So maybe we'll just, I don't know, we'll recite poetry or something. Dave Lundy, of course, Democrat. Chris Roebling, the Republican. Touche, our segment on national politics, where the two of them just argue for 15 minutes, comes up after the news at 7:30. Susan Noyes is going to join us tonight. She is the founder of Make It Better Media, which is a great media company that's actually celebrating their 10th anniversary this year, mostly serving the northern Chicago suburbs. We're going to talk to her about how it started, how it all began, but also just this concept of social entrepreneurship and what a media company is in her eyes. You know, because we always talk about media companies in Chicago. We throw around Trunk and Sun-Times, Rapports, Reader. You know, we don't necessarily let that circle get any bigger than the three or four publications that are just in print, not to mention online or electronic media, like radio, things like that. So what Susan's been doing with Make It Better Media is something that is obviously worthwhile. 10 years, and it keeps going strong. Great numbers. So we'll talk with Susan Noyes. She'll be my guest at the big table tonight. We'll talk about the idea of social entrepreneurship, but also how you keep a company like Make It Better going after 10 years strong. Tonight, industry night. Chef owner Joaquin Soler will be here. Small's Barbecue, one of my favorite places. It kind of shut down temporarily this winter. They put a thing up saying they were going to try renovations and change some equipment out, had a lot of things going on, and they would be back. And they came out this week on Facebook and said, you know what, we're not coming back. permanently closing. We'll talk with Chef Scholler. He'll be in studio tonight, and we'll talk to him about what's next. And also, you know, we talk so much about the successful restaurants, and this was a tremendously successful restaurant that outgrew its space, that had trouble and challenges with just being able to serve the community and the people that were coming from all over the city. I can attest, I came from downtown to Albany Park to do carry out. It's pretty crazy. So we'll talk with Chef Solaire in industry night tonight. Also, we'll talk about Mezcal, the smoky cousin to tequila. Talk about that. And then Show You Suck is in studio, the Chicago rapper, part of the new collaboration of Air Credits. Just played the Logan Square Arts Festival this weekend. Saw a ton of videos and stuff on my Instagram feed. Love him. He was in here not too long, probably 2 years ago now. But he is going to perform live tonight, Studio 435. How great is that? News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's do the carryout. All right, here are today's top stories. This afternoon, the Congressional Budget Office came out with numbers analyzing the current Senate health care bill, and they said that 22 million people would lose their insurance under this plan. This is a million less than the prediction on the House bill, so yay! Also, the deficit would go down by $320 million. This news, plus experts saying that most insurance premiums will go up, has GOP senators being very cautious till they all pass it on Thursday. Kellyanne Conway summed it up. She said that if you don't like the cost of insurance, go get a job with benefits. Oh, that's all you have to do? I think the American people were waiting for permission. Everybody, now's the time. Let's go to Monster.com, and we'll get you a full-time job with benefits, preferably from a large corporation, because small businesses, they can't afford it. What a weird thing to say, right? I mean, I thought Republicans were all for the American dream, opening your own business, pulling yourself up, making something of yourself. Now it's go buy a couple pair of pleated Dockers and get yourself in a cubicle. The old accounting firm, like Deloitte & Touche. USA! USA! So not the best news, but again, these are all CBO predictions, not truth. So it could be that nobody loses insurance and the deficit is paid down by a gazillion dollars. So nothing to see here, folks. Move along. Let's move on to the travel ban. It looks like the U.S. Supreme Court will rule on the constitutionality of whether or not we can ban citizens from certain countries coming to the U.S. Critics say it's a thinly veiled Muslim ban and that it's against who we are as a country, seeing that we're built on immigrants. Trump called it a victory. So I guess starting tomorrow, no more people from Yemen. But something tells me we really didn't have any of those people coming in to begin with, right? I mean, but hey, politics is more about who says it than actually who does it. The Supreme Court's also going to take up the wedding cake case where a business refused to make a cake for a gay couple and they were fined for it. Oh, man, we got to go back to this. Really? Didn't we already decide this as a country? Is this really what the next 3 years are going to be? Just retrying stuff from 2010? Come on, move forward. Also, the bishop of the Catholic Church in Springfield seems to think this is where we're going. He sent a decree last week saying that same-sex couples can't have communion or funeral rites in his archdiocese. Pope Francis said, yeah, but we give communion to a lot of people that the rule of the church say we shouldn't, so let it go. Nope, not the bishop of Springfield. He's going rogue. Again, are we going backwards here? And if we are, maybe not the best look for the Catholic Church. Am I the only one who bought Spotlight on demand? Maybe just go forward instead of past. Mayor Rahm Emanuel said that billionaire investor Elon Musk is interested in the mayor's pet project to build a high-speed train from downtown to O'Hare Airport. The idea would be awesome and stupid at the same time. Awesome in getting to the city in no time and stupid in what it would cost for both the construction and for the ticket. And, I mean, think about what the... I mean, if the cab people are mad at Uber right now, I mean, wait till a train undercuts that cash flow. I mean, who will take cabs at all if you can't take a $35 cab to O'Hare, to downtown? You know what I mean? Yikes, I think they'd be lining up. We need all those forces that are protesting Uber. We're pulling you off. We got something else to protest. In weather, what a weekend, huh? I didn't think I could love 70 degrees the way I love 70 degrees right now. I've always been like an 80, 82 type, you know, but I'm digging on this 70 degree joint. Sunny, warm with a cool breeze. Where's my pina colada? In sports, the Cubs in Washington tonight for a big showdown with the NL East leading Nationals. It's a big one for the Cubs, who came off a mediocre split with the Marlins over the weekend. And if that's not enough, an ailing shoulder keeps Addison Russell sidelined. The Cubs are playing rookies tonight, and Wilson Contreras is the latest Cub to lead off. The Cubs' depth chart is seriously being tested. Russell, Zobrist, Haywood, Schwarbert, out. Almora, Happ, Candelario, and Mark Zagunas. Mark Zagunas is in right tonight, guys. That's all I got to say. Not what we expected going into the 4th of July weekend for this season, huh? The Cubs should get some of their players back for the weekend, but geez, time to panic yet? We still chill? We good? Cubs are game over 500? I guess if you stay close enough to the Brewers, then you got to play them a ton in the second half. It'll be fine. The Nationals, not as fun to play the 80s game with since they've only been the Nationals for like a minute. But they did come from Montreal, so here we go. Any old Expos with the Nationals still with this team? Is Hubie Brooks still playing? What about a Mitch Webster? Chris Spire? Chris Spire still at short? How about Bill Gullickson? Does Gully have a role with the current squad? Unacceptable. Turning to the South Side, the Sox are really buying into this rebuilding thing, aren't they? They got swept by the Oakland A's over the weekend, lost 6-7. Oh, what are the positives on the South Side? Avi Garcia is playing well, and Carlos Rodon is scheduled to make his first start of the season this week. Other than that, I don't know. It's falling apart. The Sox are back in the cellar, 7.5 back, 10 games under 500. And now the Yankees come to town. Whew! They're having a great year behind marquee names like Aaron Judge and Gary Sanchez, Starlin Castro. But after that, I mean, who's on the Yankees anymore? Is Ron Guidry? Is he still in the rotation? How about a Steve Balboni? Did DH? Steve Balboni? What about Mike Pagliarulo? Is Mike Pagliarulo still playing for the Yankees? Anybody? The White Sox retired Mark Burley's number this weekend. Best tidbit, he had a few drinks before being called in to close out the World Series. Fresh. And then I read something that he doesn't know what 16-inch softball is, so we never loved you anyway, Mark. All right, anything else to talk about with the Bulls? Jimmy Butler gone. Former NBA star Antoine Walker said that Butler was a bad locker room guy, and that's why the Bulls had to part with him. That's not a surprise. Okay. Also, Lauri Markkanen, he's the first Finnish player in the NBA. So, there's that. And finally, a new study says that kids can inherit geeky traits from their older dads. So that explains why you brought back that pencil protector and suspenders. You thought you were being ironic. Nope, you're not a hipster. You're your dad. That's the carryout for June 26, 2017. Hey, we have leftover rainbow cake. We're going to keep selling it through July. Nobody's going to know the difference. All right, coming up, Touche, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling are here. We will get to the bottom of Russian investigations, healthcare, and the travel ban. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well.
How was the weekend?
Not bad. Not bad. I saw a lot of the pictures from the Pride Parade. It looks like you guys had fun.
I know. Everybody took the same picture with Bozo. It was like the thing. We all had to do it, I guess.
Well, you know.
It was good.
Got to be part of the crew.
Well, it was funny because Pete and I talked about this earlier. We had grandiose plans when we were done with the parade. Like, you know, we're going to go back. It's going to hang out. It's going to do other things. No, I hit the couch and I was out.
Yeah. That's not a lot of walking, man.
Yeah, I did not do a good job with my stamina. That was a big mistake.
I've been part of those parades, most notably the St. Patrick's Day parade, where you start drinking in the morning and you do forget how long the parade route is.
Right.
And then,
exactly.
Nowhere to go.
Well, you know, luckily I didn't have the drinking. I got that. It was too hot and too much.
Yeah.
Too much. But at the same time, I think I felt like when I got home, I felt like, I had already like polished off six drinks, even though I hadn't. So
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right. You go right. You go left.
All right. Left to right. So we are Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio for another episode of Touché here on the
Touché.
Download. Lots to talk about. We agree on everything, so I don't know what we're going to do tonight.
Is this as close as we get to the longest day of the year? Or we were on just before the longest day.
Yeah, you're right.
But I mean,
right
it's now. Pretty darn.
I know.
It's like midday sun out there.
It looks like it's 3:00.
It's lovely. Yeah. It's absolutely perfect evening.
All right. The Congressional Budget Office is out with its estimation of what the cost would be for the Senate healthcare bill. We've argued this before, but Dave, not great numbers. I mean, once again, sort of sets this grim picture of what healthcare is going to look like in the next 10 years.
Well, I am so gratified that the U.S. Senate decided, the Republicans in the U.S. Senate decided, they were going to listen to the president, who said the House bill was too mean, and the 23 million people the House bill would have cut off, and so now you're only going to have 22 million lose insurance while you impose lifetime caps in some states, while you increase premiums by 20% next year and cut 14 million people off.
What's
health.
Good about this, Chris?
Okay, David, what's your idea?
My idea is let's fix the marketplaces, fix Obamacare, make sure that the insurance companies are protected, stop sabotaging it, sit down with Republicans and Democrats and work together. Touché!
And we should trust you because you got it right the first time?
Let's see. We got 20%, the lowest uninsured rates in modern history. Yeah, I feel pretty good about that. Thanks
very
much.
Well, I think we're still about, I don't know, 35 million people uninsured in the
country.
But
what's good about it, Chris? What do you like
about it?
What's
good about it is there are two competing visions for how something as important as healthcare should be allocated in a free economy, in a free society. And one of them is represented by David, and that's sort of top-down government control and one size fits all, and you have to do what we tell you. Like you have to pay the fine or buy the insurance policy that's not right for you.
Just like when you're car
so
insurance.
That's the David program. Our program, I think the Enlightened program, is that there are any number of ways for people to insure themselves and to take care of themselves. And that what we need and what we've had in this country since World War II, because of the disruptions in the marketplace caused by the coming home of troops after World War II, is just this increasing curve of government intervention. We need transparency in the market. We need certainty in the market. We need competition in the market. None of that comes from the greater hand of government, which is being animated by David Lundy.
Why has the government been involved since World War II? Because prices have become unaffordable?
No, government was involved. Government's been involved. Government created Medicare. Government created the GI Bill. Government put veterans on health, gave veterans health insurance and health care. The government has been involved in health insurance. In health care in this country for literally generations. There's nothing inherently wrong with the government being involved. It needs to be a balance. Really? So you would advocate getting rid of Medicare then, I assume?
No, I think what we have...
Well, if you don't like government involvement, you got to get rid of Medicare.
That's not true.
Yes, you do.
First of all, you said there's nothing inherently wrong with government involvement.
Yes.
What I'm talking about is government giving money to people who need choices so that people can make a decision. Government doesn't allocate those resources for the people. And David forgets his history. Here's why government got involved after World War II. We had wage and price controls in the late 40s to moderate the impact of troops coming home. May have been a good idea, may have been a bad idea. Milton Friedman actually worked on it. But in any case, employers could not reward employees with wage differentials. And so employers went to Congress and said, "We under wage and price controls, we cannot change wages. We want to start giving benefits." And Congress said, "Really? Like what?" And they said, "We would like to give health care so that when people come work for us, they get health care. But in exchange for that, Congress, we would like to be able to deduct that on our income taxes." Congress said, thinking this is a great idea, they said, "Sure, we'll let you deduct that." And that was the first real step of government into the marketplace.
And would you have opposed that, Chris? Because it sounds like
it doesn't matter what happened.
No, you just said the government cannot be involved.
I'm sorry, David. You're not able to state my position. My position is...
Well, you're not able to state your position.
I'm doing a better job than you are with yours. Because look at the results of Obamacare. I go back to my original. You didn't get it right the first time. Why should we trust you this time? But here's the deal. We have not looked architectonically at all of these interventions in the market. David is right to point out Medicaid and Medicare and eventually catastrophic insurance. And we carved out something for kids with CHIPS. We've done a lot of different things. Then we have segments. I live in Alaska. The Bureau of Indian Affairs ran healthcare in Alaska. There are other people who are veterans. And veterans' healthcare is run by a single-payer program, and people die waiting for procedures, just like they do in Canada and in the UK.
All right, let me
and
ask
that's what David wants for all of us.
Let me
death.
Let me ask the question.
Government
though, because
control.
The way that we've heard this over and over is, you know, from cynics and critics that this is just a redistribution of wealth, that we're giving money to back to the wealthy because the Obamacare was essentially run by taxing rich people. Is that what you see, Dave?
That is what President Obama said, and President Obama is right, because you're giving an $800 billion tax cut. You're cutting Medicaid, $800 billion worth, and giving it as a tax break to the wealthy. Now, for wealthy people, that's awesome. I think they said the top 400 people are going to get enough of a tax break to pay for Medicaid for 750,000 people. So for people like Chris, this doesn't matter. It's okay. It's fine. But what about the people on Medicaid who are disabled? What about the people on Medicaid who are going to get cut off of Medicaid or not get services? Or I was watching a program the other night where this poor a guy in a wheelchair lives with his family. But under the proposed Republican health care bill, he's going to get thrown into an institution
state. That guy, Paul Ryan, is throwing that guy in a volcano. You mixed that one up.
No, this is a fact, and that's his
Paul
life.
Ryan is going up to the edge of the volcano and tossing the guy in. And
which
it's
is
be
great
a
for you to mock
you
that.
To
it's
the
great
idea
for you to
this
mock that, but you're not the one who's about to lose your health insurance and have to be moving out of your home.
Neither is that guy. These are scare tactics from Democrats.
No, these are facts. These are people. And that's what the CBO said.
Okay.
This bill is horrible. It is cruel. Okay. It is horrific.
Okay, great.
Tell us why it's not.
Let me tell you something.
Tell us.
What we are talking about here is a unclean hands on the part of David and all of the Democrats who came up with Medicaid funding under the federal program, which for the first few years was 100% and then went down to 90% and eventually went over under for the states so that states that would sign up like Ohio early on saying, we want the free money from Washington to take care of more people, didn't have a funding source. And when we talk about taxes, we've got $2 trillion of spending already on Obamacare. And how much have the taxes been to pay for that? $1 trillion. We are in the middle of a fiscal crisis. So, David, it is
Chris
so
is
easy
changing
for
the
Democrats.
Subject.
No,
you're changing the subject because you refuse to defend this proposal that is going to be voted on.
I absolutely defend. And when we have an hour on Chicago tonight, I'll be able to go into even more detail.
I'm waiting for
but
one point
you,
in your favor.
Well,
one point to suggest
to,
why
I'm sorry,
this is good. Not Obamacare is bad, but why is this good?
Because we're transitioning people. We've created four different ways for people who are currently on Medicaid to transition out of that. And that means people are going to be back in the private health insurance sector buying what they want. Here's number
Poor
two.
Poor people can't
I'm sorry,
do that.
You asked me to say that. That's why the transition
that's why
is
22 million are getting
sorry,
thrown off.
The transition is tax credits to empower those people to be able to buy
tax
what they want.
Tax credits don't and pay for insurance. They don't.
Number three, we've eliminated the mandate. So you don't have to buy something that doesn't work for you. And number four, we've eliminated the tax. So we're not going to be taxing everybody for a colossal failed behemoth and carcass.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, touche, getting heated up here. And this is just round one. We got round two and round three. We've got travel ban and we've got the
Russia
investigation coming up here on Touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
All right, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio tonight. Let's talk travel ban, victory for the Trump administration.
Well, no, it's not a victory. It's a victory for every American. It's the victory of law over politics. This is exactly what we said would happen. The Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit played their games and got their press and acted out like the other resistance movement, or what are they called? Resistors or whatever they're supposed to be. Anyway, that, you know, that was all ridiculous and non-legal, because the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia, actually admitted that had the same document been issued by, say, President John Kerry, President David Lundy, or Justin, it would have been legal. Okay, so they were saying, for the first time in supposed constitutional jurisprudence,
saying there was precedent.
You go outside of the document. Of course, that was ridiculous, and everybody knew it. And now there is a small exception, which the Trump people say existed anyway, but they made it explicit, and that is for folks who have had some link to the United States, to a person or institution, they are being taken care of.
Now,
that
I mentioned this a little bit earlier, Dave. I mean, this is a little bit of politics in the way that a lot of the banned countries that are already on this quote-unquote travel ban, they're not letting those guys in anyway. It's not like, you know, people from Yemen can hop a plane right now and just come into the United States without thorough checks and balance. How much of this is a political victory for Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, this is 100% politics, because remember, this is not a permanent, this is a 90-day travel ban, which they said in January was absolutely urgent. 150 days ago, they said it was absolutely urgent that we have our 90-day temporary travel ban. Well, guess what? That's 150 days ago. This is all a lot of smoke and mirrors to satisfy the campaign promise, well, which, by the way, was the point.
Is that a cynical
of the
approach,
the
though,
fourth.
Chris? I mean, because if the president of the United States...
absolutely substantive. This is not cynical.
What I'm saying is it cynical on Dave's part to say...
Yes.
That
he lost.
90, no.
He was
Let
wrong.
Let me finish. I'm actually making a point for you, Chris. But I'm just saying that the president with the safety of the country in mind wanted to do a 90-day ban from these countries because he had intel on something that.
But he didn't.
But that's the cynical approach. But
no,
the idea
it's
being,
the factual approach.
No, David, you don't know what he had.
No, we
you
no,
don't know what
zero
he had.
Evidence, and nobody from these
David,
countries has ever been involved in a terrorist attack.
David,
ever.
You know, it's not. Just it's people from the countries. It's
countries that Trump did business with have been involved in terrorist attacks. Those were excluded from the ban.
It's not just the people from the countries. I mean, it's not just people of the countries. It's people from the countries. And there is no question that we weren't getting any data on who they were. And there were people coming in. So it wasn't. This is not just for show. And there is a most important. There is the simple point, which has never been contradicted until Trump took office. And that is that the president has, according to Congress,
the authority.
This
right.
is not just
right.
This is not just the Constitution, but Congress gave all president. Obama did exactly the same thing with Iraq at the
no,
time.
No, he didn't.
Yes,
not
he
remotely
did.
Close.
He did.
No, Chris, you can't make up your own facts.
I'm sorry,
what
David.
What Obama did
you
with
have
Iraq.
These little phrases. Obama said, I am stopping immigration. We're doing extra screening.
They were not processing new immigration applications. They did not stop people at airports. I'm sorry, Chris. You're not entitled to your own facts.
I'm sorry, David. What the history
And they certainly didn't stop people with green cards. They certainly didn't stop people on student visas.
And that didn't happen here either.
Yes, okay? It did. I was in the airport.
There were mistakes made on that first
one. You guys are surly tonight. All right, let's get to the round three, which is Russia.
Wait, I want to make another point. Okay. This is a serious turning point where the collusion idea is gone.
No.
Now the obstruction idea is deflating.
No.
Now. And the travel ban opposition has finally been shown for what it is.
No.
And so you've got the country is coming back around, and guys like David who have got to say what they want to say because of who they are and where they come from. They're going to keep saying it no matter what, but the rest of us are moving on. And we're going to have a new healthcare program shortly we'll have a conference committee meeting to reconcile the Senate and the House versions.
Are you worried that that there could be a way that it doesn't get through the Senate?
Well, sure, but I think Mitch McConnell knows what he's doing, and he's going to deliver a victory for the president.
The Republicans, in a strange way, the White House has said this. Others have said this as well. If Obama knew about Russian hacking, and he should have done more as president when he had the ability to do so in 2016, Democrats are kind of rolling their eyes at that, the idea that imagine a world where the president would come out and say someone's trying to rig the election for Donald Trump. It would have been mayhem.
Oh, yeah. No, look, I think there's 2 points here. First of all, I am so glad that the president has finally admitted that the Russians meddled in this election, although Sean Spicer today walked that back some. He said, well, it's probably Russia, but it's probably other countries, too. So Donald Trump, contrary to what Chris bellowed last night on Beyond the Beltway and what he bellowed at me when I was on Beyond the Beltway, the president has never admitted that Russia meddled in the election. And even now he can't come right out and say it. So I think that's important. And yet he's done nothing about it. There was supposed to be a 90-day plan to deal with this. He's done nothing about it. According to Jeff Sessions, when he testified, he hadn't even been in a briefing on it.
No, Jeff Sessions was, hold on a second. Jeff Sessions recused himself, and so he wasn't in the briefings.
No, not on national security matters. He recused himself from the criminal investigation of the president.
David trying to have it both ways. Look, here is the point. The point is CNN fired the three people who came up with the phony story linking Trump to Russia today. They accepted the resignations of Frank Thomas, I think his name is.
Thomas Frank.
Yeah. Thomas Frank and Eric Lichtblau, the Pulitzer Prize winning former New York Times reporter who went to CNN with great fanfare and is now 6 months later out on the street. Hmm. And so I think the vast, as is indicated by the results in South Carolina, Georgia, Kansas, Montana, the rest of the country is not seeing this as the Baltimore or the Boston Washington corridor and my friend Dave Lundy. The rest of this country sees Democrats desperately grasping for what they are and understands that the real issue confronting this country is activating the economy, which is going to happen with the tax bill, which will come after the health bill.
Which is not, because the president has not proposed a tax bill. The president proposed a one-pager.
Yeah.
There is no tax bill.
And the only thing I would say, just as a, I mean, because I love you guys so much, and you're right, the
we love
employees that were that resigned, we, that was not specifically
that was specifically
no,
for
it
the
was,
report.
No, I'm reading it right now. CNN Thomas Frank, a reporter wrote for CNN Investigates, last Thursday appeared to have a compelling exclusive. The Senate Intelligence Committee reported Frank was investigating a Russian investment fund. That turned out to not be true. That's what it's about. But I'm just saying, it's not the whole thing.
CNN has said that standard editorial practice
changing
was not
the subject
met.
Again.
No, this is the falsehoods right. behind the Democrat attempt to nullify the election in November.
Okay. Chris Roebling,
they were fired
Dave
because
Lundy.
They went with a report, a story about Russia and Trump that wasn't true.
There you're right. You got you. That's right, right there.
Yes,
Dave
that
Lundy,
was right.
Chris
one
Roebling.
Moment of today's show, Chris was telling
one
the
moment
truth.
In time. Great touche tonight, guys. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, it's Industry Night, a segment we do every Monday where we talk food and hospitality. Tonight, chef owner Joaquin Soler, he was the chef owner of the barbecue place Smalls, which was in Albany Park neighborhood of Chicago, northwest side of Chicago. Tremendous, tremendous place. A couple years back, getting reviews after reviews, and it was such a small little place. It had 5 seats. And so it just became sort of a carryout destination. And over time, it just became too much. I mean, it didn't work to have so much volume and no place to actually have a restaurant. And over the winter time, he announced he was temporarily closing the restaurant just to do some tweaks, some reconcepting, change some equipment out, because you can't really do that when you have such a small place. And then this week, he announced that he's closing permanently and looking for a new space. So Chef Soler will be in studio tonight to talk about that decision and also what's next for him. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is a media mogul. Susan B. Noyes is the woman who founded Make It Better Media and the Make It Better Foundation. Make It Better is a network consisting of a magazine, a website, a newsletter, and it connects and covers the Chicago area. It's a media company that started as a website for women to connect all, I mean, to really be a place to serve all sorts of interests. But really, it's about making yourself better. But after purchasing North Shore Magazine back in 2009, Noyes and Make It Better have expanded to be more than just a website or a print magazine, but really an online community. And not just a media company, but a company that focuses on the concept of social entrepreneurship. Noyes is a lawyer, former lawyer, and Nutria board member who also had a column in North Shore magazine. She's also grown the Make It Better brand over time. She has now over a million page views a year, over 33,000 subscribers to the newsletter, 60,000 plus in print circulation. And this year celebrates the 10th anniversary. Wow. It's amazing to have a media company at 10 years. Make It Better. Susan B. Noyes is my guest tonight at the big table. Susan, thanks for joining me. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the invitation. Delighted to be here.
This is a site. I mean, it's amazing amount of numbers. I throw those numbers out, 33 here, 60,000 here, all the kind. I mean, when you started this, was that the intention? Was the intention to grow this to thousands and thousands of people around the Chicagoland area that are partaking in Make It Better?
When we started it, we hoped we would grow. We knew that we were launching a journey. It was, I had been told that when you do something online, you need to pay attention to the audience and what they want, and you give them more of what they want. And we just wanted to sort of figure out how to do it for North Shore women, meaning women who lived in Evanston and Nutria Township. And we've just, it's just morphed.
What did they want? What more did they want?
So we actually did a substantial survey. When you're doing anything in media, as you know, it's all about the demographics
right,
in the survey.
Right.
And the number one thing was 92% of them would change their brand loyalty if they thought it would make the world a better place. And they go out of their way to make life better, not just for themselves, but for others.
So they're attracted to a brand that has that quality.
Deep in their DNA. And because we launched this 10 years ago, this is before it was about the same time that the iPhone was launched and Facebook was just starting to take off. So think about what someone called it a weblog as opposed to a website.
Right.
And we didn't really know what would come, but we knew that they wanted to be fit, they liked to eat, they liked their family education and health.
It's a little bit more lifestyle, yeah.
And it was very much about how do you use the internet to amplify volunteering, philanthropy, fundraising. So we sort of deeply embedded that in our DNA, and we actually grew by being a media sponsor of every little nonprofit that came along and said, oh, could you please tell the story about our fundraiser? And that's the thing
really? Okay.
That differentiated us from everyone else. And that's the thing that people love the best. So our mission is to be the most trusted, easiest to use community resource and magazine that helps you make your life and the lives of others better. And that's our real point of differentiation.
Well, I mean, it also ties into this concept, and I mentioned in the lead, this idea of social entrepreneurship, which is something we do as a business segment on the show. We have a lot of entrepreneurs on. Explain the concept of social entrepreneurship and how that's different than just regular run-of-the-mill entrepreneurship.
So thanks for asking. By the way, 10 years ago, I didn't know what a social entrepreneur was. And it was about 3 years ago, I was like, oh, we're social entrepreneurs. The concept is you are looking for the maximum impact on others and on their lives and the maximum good for your dollar, for your minute, for your hour. And when you watch what's happening in business, more and more the businesses that are succeeding, like the Whole Foods, Starbucks, have a deeply embedded social impact. You know that when you go in, you might be spending a little bit more, but you're supporting a family,
right,
a local farm. So that's
so it's really about company or starting a business because and giving back. The idea that not only are you making a profit, but you're giving back to some part. You're trying to make someone else better.
Exactly. And I actually think it's deep in all of our DNAs. We want to do that. We want to do the most we can with our dollars and our time.
Is there a challenge to that as an entrepreneur, someone who's starting a media company, that if you're going to go into that area and you're going to give back in certain, is it just the idea that perhaps, you know, you're giving some of your profits away to charity? I mean, is the challenge just financial? What are some of the challenges of keeping up with growth and all the other things when you're in the realm of social entrepreneurship?
Such a good question. I think it's a slower start. I think that you don't make money as fast, but I think that in the long run, you are more successful and you attract higher quality customers. So I look at who our deeply embedded advertising and marketing partners are, and I am so proud of who they are. Mm-hmm. They are really the leaders in whatever their industry is. Are you familiar with the book by Adam Grant, Give and Take?
Not Give and Take, but we had Adam Grant on the show. We were talking about, I can't remember, I'll look it up in the break, but we had Adam on as a guest, yeah.
Oh, I envy you. Yeah. Yes, I interviewed him once for when he spoke at Nutrier, and I am such his fan. And his philosophy in Give and Take, it is that the true leaders are the ones who are the givers, but it's a slower start. Instead of 3 years to success, it's 8 years to success.
And I would assume that probably gets in the way of some entrepreneurs' idea of what success is. If they have to wait 8 years instead of three, they're not cut out for the idea of social entrepreneurship.
Unless you're counting lives made better. So that's kept me going, you know, that I didn't get to profit fast, but And I still see that. I see the social impact, and that's why our community keeps growing. Others see it too.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break. We'll come back, and I want to talk about content versus community, or how they interact with each other. Which one, you know, when you as a content creator and you create a whole website and obviously the magazine Make It Better, I mean, you're putting a lot of stuff out. Is the content, I mean, when you're inside the magazine or inside the company, is content the king? Is that the first things first? Because you'll hear that. They write it up on the chalkboard at the, you know, at the Sun Tribune or the Sun-Time, content is king. Or is community king in this case? And that's what we'll talk about. Susan Noyes is my guest. Make It Better is the media company we're talking about. She's my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Susan B. Noyes, my guest in studio. She's the founder of Make It Better Media and Make It Better, the Make It Better Foundation. Make It Better, you got your big newest magazine, the new issue, the July-August, Make It Better, the best of 2016. It's really the poll. You put out the survey for the best of this, best of that, and it's coming out this week. Magazine production, what a business, huh?
A complicated one, a lot of moving parts.
I want to get into your story because you were a lawyer, you're a labor lawyer, who decided to take time off for your family. And how did you find your way to running a media company?
It's a journey. When I took time off to raise my family, I didn't know I was going to do this, but I ended up having six kids because I was enjoying it. And by the time the oldest one was going off to college, the youngest was in about third grade, and I thought, okay, I need my what's next. I have a lot of energy. And I thought, I have the opportunity to practice what I've been preaching to my kids. Find what you love, and the rest will follow. But I that actually launched me on about a two-year journey of, okay, so what do I love?
Right. How did you come? I mean, what was your first thought on that? We're all going through that ourselves in any form.
I love to organize a lot of moving pieces. Okay. I love to write. I love the power of stories. I was doing a lot of community service and philanthropy and board service. And then I read Katharine Graham's autobiography. And I was like, that's it. I can do all the things that I love and be a publisher and really have some impact. And that was the thing that, you know, turned that switch.
What it surprises me when I read about the about Make It Better and is about how much the word connector is thrown around. You know, when we talk about media companies, it's always there's different ways to tell stories and there's different job titles. And you can see it at either here or at the Tribune sometimes, whatever. But connector, tell us about why it's important for you and for anyone who works at Make It Better to be a connector.
Oh, that's... You ask good questions. So it was just embedded in our DNA, too. So when we launched the website 10 years ago, we reached out and said, hey, are you a community connector? Do you care what's going on in your community?
What's a connector? What does that mean?
It's a person who just naturally facilitates the connection of people and ideas that belong together. So, and it's what you do... what a good marketer does.
Right.
Good fundraiser does. It's also what great civic leaders do. They understand how to connect the businesses and the thought leaders to try to solve a problem and move this world forward.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know that starting in 2007 and what you wanted to do with it took, I don't know if it took a turn or it amplified in 2009 when you took over. You bought North Shore Magazine. That's for a lot of people who know Chicago media, that was a big staple. That was a big magazine in Chicago. People knew it. Tell us about that. Tell about the idea of expanding your company to the way where you were going to start to grab properties outside of Make It Better.
Thank you for asking. So when we launched that website, I had Medill School of Journalism and the Media Management Center approach me and say, like, we really like what you're doing with the website. So could our graduate students for a whole quarter adopt it and study it and come back with some recommendations? And it's sort of like having a McKinsey.
Oh, yeah, you'll take it, right?
And at the end of the quarter, they came back and said, well, you need to reorganize it this way, but you're really on to something. And by the way, you should do a print magazine. Savvy advertisers still want to reach your demographic, which is these affluent suburban moms. And those women love a nice quality magazine. So at the time, as you mentioned, I was writing a column in North Shore Magazine, and I actually negotiated a contract to buy North Shore Magazine. And that's when, oh my God.
That's quite to be the columnist, to be like, you know what? I'm not just going to write the column. I'm going to buy the magazine too.
Well, but what happened was, this is when Conrad Black was the owner, and you know, the numbers were really funny. So I did the due diligence and walked away from that, and ended up, and about 3 or 4 months later, the man who was the publisher of the Pioneer Press then, his name was Larry Green, who was a brilliant publisher, sometimes fired him. I reached out to Larry and said, I think I want to launch a fresh new magazine. Will you help? So hired him, launched the magazine, and then 10 months later had, at that time, Miserable Financial had purchased Sun-Times.
Right, right.
And they approached me and said, you're putting us out of business. So wouldn't you like to buy the assets anyway? And I was able to buy it for 1/10 of that original negotiated contract.
Wow, there you go, see? Well, I mean, and to become at that moment to have that property in, to talk about, you know, expanding Make It Better, to be able to grab the things that North Shore Magazine had, circulation, marketing, newsletter, all that kind of stuff. I mean, as someone
who's, and 30 years of history.
And 30 years,
right?
Of history.
So,
what was the emotion around that? The idea, what was the feeling at that moment of having that come into your company? Because it takes you from a website, we just started a publishing company, but now you're a player.
Exactly. It felt great. And when I walked away from that first contract, I actually hurt for about 3 weeks because I really didn't want to do that. So I was so excited. Thank you very much for asking.
I like how grateful you are for the questions. Yeah. Let's take that. All right. So, you know, as much as we're celebrating the idea of putting Make It Better in magazine form and taking over North Shore, it's still a magazine. And, you know, as we've heard so much about print and the decline of print and how difficult it is for people to continue to put things on paper, especially when you have such a successful operation online, do you feel the same crunch? I mean, as Make It Better? I mean, because you have this great glossy magazine. I'm holding the new one in my hand. Do you still feel the crunch of, you know, this is great, but it takes a lot to put this together?
We do. We absolutely feel the crunch. And you will see in this next issue a request to our audience to say, listen, we actually could do better if we discontinued the print magazine.
Really?
But we know that a lot of you really like it. So there are things that you could do to help make this continue. And we put a survey out there. A simple thing to do, I don't know how much you know about print and mailing, but
no.
if our audience just checks, yes, I request to receive this, and 50% plus one of the total number we mail are requested, we cut our mailing cost in half.
Wow.
So that's a big chunk of money right there at $1 a copy.
Yeah, right. I mean, and if they come back tomorrow, if you get all these back in and say, you know, we really love this, we don't want to lose it. And it's cost prohibitive, meaning, you know, it's tough to put this together, like you said. I mean, do you stick with what your audience wants? Do you have to sort of, you know, give them some bad medicine? It's just like, hey, listen, this is good for you, but we're not going to do the magazine anymore.
Well, it's, as you know, in media and publishing, it is a balance of what do they want and what's good business decision. And we want to do the most good for the most people we can with every little.
But what I like about Make It Better, whether it be the magazine or whether it be the content or whatever. We'll get into the content as well. But just the idea that there is a real, I mean, you're paying attention to what the audience is consuming, their patterns, their demographics. You are taking the analytics that are provided to you and you're applying them. You're draping it over the content. So, I mean, in a way, I love the idea that you're saying, do you want this anymore?
Exactly.
I mean, it's great.
But if you don't, then right. Why are we doing it? But because we could do more for you and give you what you want.
But the problem, I guess, at the end of the day, and this is where maybe it's a social entrepreneur problem that's very specific, is that Tribune or Sun-Times, if they're going to discontinue, they're going to do it whether the audience likes it or not. They're most interested in their bottom line. The question I have for you is just, at the end of the day, even if they all came back and said, we love it, we want to keep it, and it hurts your bottom line as a company, do you have to part ways with the philosophy of giving the customer what they want?
No. What I'm saying is if our audience wants it, they're either going to say, yes, enough of us are going to request it, or we're actually asking, will you spend money for this? And I hear this all the time, anecdotally, which is a very different thing than doing the
survey. Yeah.
The survey. But people are always coming up and saying, we love the magazine. Why don't you charge for it?
Like, so you're
and
gonna,
where,
yeah.
Where do you ever hear that anymore in this world, right?
Yeah, it's true. Susan B. Noyes is the founder of Make It Better Media and Make It Better, the Make It Better Foundation. Of course, Make It Better, the magazine, the website, the electronic newsletter. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back, and I want to ask the question about content and community, and you know, ask you other questions about, you know, some of the challenges for media companies in this day and age. Susan B. Noyes, my guest tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Susan B. Noyes is my guest tonight. She is the founder of Make It Better Media and the Make It Better Foundation. We're talking about the magazine. We're talking about the website, the newsletter that really connects the Chicago area. It started as really a website to connect the northern suburbs and primarily women in the northern suburbs. You have a 92%, you know, reading your media kit today, and it's 92% female readership. Is that by design? I mean, are you still at this as you reach out and you expand? Is it a media property for women?
We started as a media property for women. We actually know that our online audience is almost 40% male.
Really?
They want to know where to eat and how to make their family life better too. So we are intentionally expanding to cover more subjects that men are interested in, but we are trying not to lose that original female-centric vision because it's working for us.
Right. Particularly for you as someone who now you're celebrating your 10th anniversary, is there a particular style when you talk about lifestyle media companies that are geared towards women? I mean, you know exactly what they want, especially talking about northern suburbs, you know, the women that live in that area. I mean, have you from doing this for 10 years, you know exactly what they want?
I'm going to bet that when I describe our core audience, it sounds like your wife and some of the other women that you know too. Fitness is really important. Exercise and healthy diet, meaningful experiences, travel, their home and how you decorate your home. But really it's about being a lifelong learner, education, and taking proactive care of your health and reaching out and lifting up others in the process. So we're taking care of our kids and we're taking care of our friends and we're taking care of our husband and our schools and our nonprofits. And if there's a little bit of time left over, we take care of ourselves. So
well,
it is food, fitness, fashion, home, ways to make a difference, and money. Money, money, money. We are all about talking to women
about money.
And there's a lot of opportunity to do that.
That has to become more and more as this media landscape becomes online.
Mm-hmm.
The competition for those marketplaces are much more fierce than they ever have been. I mean, you see now, even you think about There will be political sites that are for women. There will be, you know, sports sites that are for women. I mean, the market has been sort of fractured down to demographics, and we see it in all sorts of sites. Is it? Do you notice that in the landscapes? It's become tougher to be able to retain the audience and community that you fostered over 10 years?
No. Thank you for asking that, too. When new people join the email newsletter, they don't all stay. When new people come find their way to the site, they don't all always return. But we have a core audience who's been loyal from the start. And as others who are similar to them, similar demographics, find their way, they usually keep coming back too. So, and our point of differentiation isn't just that we write about those things just for them. We write about those things for them, for their families, and we always embed a way that you can click here and know that it's going to make the world a better place.
You have to, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean, you're competing with the Real Simples and the apartment therapies of the world. And I mean that in the way that that more and more women who are sampling media sites, like I said, I mean, they can go anywhere. And there are brands that can get so particular to even a very small swath of age. You know, so this is really great for 21 to 24. This is really great from 30 to 33. It's amazing to think what has happened with the online media landscape.
So what I can tell you is that there's a broad swath of sites that do new moms and preschools and younger moms, but there really isn't quite what we do. And it by the time it's middle school, your kids are middle school age and on, we don't have a lot of competitors, and that's
interesting.
That's a good point of differentiation.
Where do you think lifestyle sites, for someone who's done one for 10 years, where do they go wrong? Where does, when I think of products and properties, and even the local ones, I mean, what are they doing that if you were in charge of them, you would correct?
Well, first of all, I think too much talk about luxury is actually wrong. I think that everyone, the true luxury is time. And we're not just spending money to be seen looking good. The luxury is make it easier for me to have a great experience. Make it easier for me to, have clothes and items in my home that feel good and look good. But I'm not looking for that, what used to be the lux, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
The $1,000 dress that, or thousand, geez.
Exactly.
10,000. Yeah.
And you can even see that with Princess Kate in England. It's been fascinating to watch her show up in Target-like outfits, too, with her jewels. So that's one. So it's not all about luxury. And audience actually is really smart. So if you give them advertorial, but it's not marked that, it doesn't take them very long to understand
that. Figure that out.
Somebody else has bought this. This isn't really.
Do you? I mean, is that something, you know, as in that space, in that lifestyle space, and Make It Better, just like everywhere else? I mean, there's a lot of advertisers who want to do that kind of stuff. They want to do that advertorial, as you say. I mean, they want to do it where it fits to the feel, or they want it to be an ad that looks like a story. And we see that all the time. Do you, as a publisher and as a founder, you have to kind of push back on that?
No, I just make more money for it because we clearly market sponsored content. So we make it obvious that's what it is. But if it's written in our voice and with our style, and it's an advertiser that we're proud to work with, and it actually, we always think about, we are solving problems. What's the evergreen problem that we're writing about that somebody wants to solve? Breast cancer,
sure.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So that's it's we're flipping that model too. Like, happy to do it if you're good enough for us, and we're going to charge you more for the sponsored content.
And I would assume that, I mean, if you're going to be in the market of social entrepreneurship, if Make It Better is all about making lives better, do you have a standard or an ethic when it comes to someone who comes in and goes, yeah, I sell cigarettes, booze, and, like everything that's an antithesis of what Make It Better is? I mean, do you have some sort of ethic to say that's not something for our magazine?
Yes. And we just use it as a filter. And we talk about it actually as a company. Okay, do we want to take this alcohol brand on? Some we do and some we don't. And there's values embedded in it. We now have a growing relationship with a casino, the River Rivers. Yeah. And they had to explain to us how they make the world a better place for real before we would take that on. So it's...
When we talk content, and, you know, because I look at the site, and there's great stuff, not just in the magazine, but on the site. I mean, the newsletter just came out, had a lot of recipes around avocados, which was great. but I, you know, when you talk about so much about community and so much about the following and so much about making it almost a, clearing a space for a demographic, what's the most important thing? Is it content or is it that community? Meaning, are you making sure you have the best content possible on the site? Or is at the end of the day, it's more of the experience for the community that surrounds the site?
So that's such a good question. And it's something that we wrestle with because we do aspire to grow beyond here. And we know that we have people who find their way to our site from the coast and other places. Mundelein. So we make sure that at least 3/5 of our content or 3/5 of every story online is nationally relevant. So as long as we are citing the national thought leaders, in addition to whoever the local leader is, right, then we feel like we're serving both.
We hear so much about media properties in this town. We hear, you know, when you hear about who's going to buy this paper or what's happening as a paper tries to shift from the newsprint to digital. You know, I mean, Chicago is known in some ways as a media town. Do you feel like you fit in with that that saying? Like, do you feel it Make It Better is part of the media ecosystem that includes the big papers and the alt weeklies and all the other things that are happening in this town?
I do, and I think that's in part because we're so different from the rest of them. So, first of all, female owned and primarily female driven is different than most of the others. And we think about what we're doing as creating virtuous circles. And there are other media companies that tell stories about solving a problem in the city and who's coming together to make it happen. But like, we do it with every single action and every single story, and nobody else is doing that. And so it's a point of difference that works. You know, Chicago is the most philanthropic city in the United States by 50%.
Wow.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So the Chicago Community Trust commissioned a study to celebrate their, I think, 75th or 100th anniversary from the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University because they wanted to make sure that they celebrated by making Chicago the most philanthropic city in the country. And IU did the study for 9 months, came back and said, guess what?
You are.
Right. By 50%. Most of the cities, it's 2% of the corporations or 2%. Corporations give 2%. The individuals give 2%. We are closer to 3%. 50% more philanthropic. Wow. And I think it has something to do with the Midwesternness and the other-centeredness of good Midwesterns. But that also means that Make It Better really does belong here. I don't think it's a surprise that we started here. And I think that that's another point of difference that allows us to be in here as a media property in this media-centric city.
I always think about, that's a great point, the idea of philanthropy.
We solve problems here.
If you are a media entity that part of the business structure is that you're not only serving up content or you're telling the stories of not only food and lifestyle and things that are around you, but you're trying to get the community to go one step further and believe in the things that are going to make this city better. Tell me from the 10 years of experience of doing that and having a community that is really at the center of this philanthropic movement, the idea that Chicago is better than everywhere else, what does that? What moves people? What moves people to reach into their pocket and say, you know, this is a cause that I'm interested in. This is something, you know, I read this article. I definitely want to move here. I mean, you studied the demographics and the analytics. What is it that gets someone who's a Make It Better reader to actually go one step further and give back to their community?
So I would say three things. One is a well-told story. Make them laugh, make them cry, make them think and want to take action. You know, it's hard for you to read about a child who's had something horrific to them and someone swooped in and helped and now their parents are trying to raise money to make it possible for other kids to have something similar. So that engaging story, that moves you story, that's one. Absolutely. And in this city, it's really true. It needs to feel like venture philanthropy. In other words, you need to prove that the money is going to be really well spent.
We actually have,
through a Make It Better Foundation and our philanthropy awards, we've sort of identified five things that we know help people believe that whatever the nonprofit is, they think like a venture philanthropy, and so they'll trust it more. And the third is connection. There's somebody that you trust has reached out to you and said, this is really a good cause to support. Wouldn't you join me in that?
Yeah.
So those are the three things I think work.
Susan, for you, I mean, we started this kind of conversation really tonight talking about, you know, the venturing out and starting a career after your youngest was in third grade. And what you told us is follow your heart and follow your passion. Is this your passion? I mean, after 10 years of doing this work, I mean, do you feel like you are following your heart, that this is what you envisioned in your head when you realized you had to move on to the next thing?
So can I tell you that sitting here talking to you and answering your questions, my heart is singing. So I think so, yes. Is it hard? Has this journey been hard? Yes. And there are times I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I feel like Moses wandering in the desert for 40 years. So I think I'm still doing it.
Susan B. Noyes is the founder of Make It Better Media and the Make It Better Foundation. You can find, I mean, it's a website. It's a newsletter. Just look it up, makeitbetter.net, right?
Subscribe to Make It Better. It's the Better Letter. It comes out twice a week. Please help us grow and
there
grow
you go.
The good, too.
The Better Letter. Susan B. Noyes, my guest tonight, celebrating 10 years of Make It Better. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin. Really enjoyed it.
All right, coming up, industry night, a twofer tonight. We're going to talk a little mezcal, the smoky cousin, the agave plant. Looking forward to that. The guys from Quixote will be here, the Logan Square restaurant. It's on all the great lists for best of, new restaurants, all that kind of stuff. They'll be here. And then we'll talk with Chef Solaire, the owner of Small's Barbecue, which just this week announced that they are permanently closing the space. We kind of knew that because they had kind of gone with the temporarily closed for the last 6 months for repairs, for reconcepting, this, that, and the other. It's a small barbecue shop, Filipino barbecue, up in Albany Park. Loved it. So good. I mean, it was the smallest place I've ever been in, but it was amazing, and I found myself doing carry out across town and just driving all the way up there, getting it and driving it all the way home. How you holding up, Pete?
Feeling great.
You are feeling great. You had a hunk of sugar today. Pete, if you don't follow the show closely enough, Pete is off of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
You got rid of it in your life.
Out of my life.
And today, we for Blind Services of Chicagoland they have their summer camp, and Pete and I were their guest judges for a peanut butter and jelly contest. And the idea is that the kids who are all visually impaired go to the store. I think it was last week. They get the stuff. It's part of a mobility lesson. The idea that they go on their own with the counselors. They pick the ingredients they want to make the best peanut butter and jelly possible.
Mm-hmm.
Then they come back and they make them. And then Pete and I, we judged. And all of the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches all had candy. It was just straight up candy. So it was, this is, what's your name? And they'd be like, this is my, is this peanut butter and jelly? And it's also got Reese's Pieces. And it's got peanut butter and chocolate and marshmallow and cotton candy and sour candy and Pop Rocks and Nerds and some cheese. And you're like, and so I was so cute, and it was great because they really put their heart and soul into these. And they were good. They were goofy, you know, nothing that you're going to gag on. But the winner had slices of American cheese and chips and Pop Rocks, and it was a culinary delight.
Yeah, of industry night.
Absolutely.
I could see in her future.
I could see that. And the best part was that there were 15 or 16, it was like 17 kids, and they all had a sandwich, and we had to sample each one.
They were all good.
And by the eighth one, I was going into a diabetic shock. I was like, this is, oh my God, this is too much. And I'm like, poor Pete, who hasn't had sugar in a year and a half. It's like, this has a Three Musketeers bar? Okay, let me try it. I was like, I don't think you're going to make it out of there. Is your body reactive? Have you felt anything?
No, I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was thinking, like, at some point in the middle, I had this, this feeling of when Barney on The Simpsons was off of beer for a while, and then he had, like, he accidentally had a beer or something. It was like, it begins! I thought I was going to go into the tailspin, and I'm like, start in any time where I can find sugar. I'm like, got to get in my system, but
no, it's been okay.
Been able to refrain for...
I feel bad, for the second half of our show tonight, because it could, at any moment, we could hit that sugar cliff and be like, ooh, and we'd just be like, what's up? What's this?
I did have to walk to Dudo to get my $1.10.
You did?
I had to get my $1.10 coffee.
I skipped it today, so yeah, I skipped it, yeah.
I've reached peak old person, too, where I go with exact change. I grab $1.10 out of like our change bucket, you know, at home.
You keep it in your breast pocket of your shirt too.
Yeah,
straight up.
And then I go, like, I'm embarrassed by having the exact change. So like I pretend like I've never been there before. Even though I go to the same Dunkin' Donuts to the same person, I pretend like I don't know. He goes, it's $1.10. I'm like, oh, it's a dollar.
Oh, that's
ten.
Amazing.
Oh,
really? That's what I have.
Might
in
have a dollar. I might have exact.
I have
change.
That in nickels. That's ridiculous. Well, it was a good cause today, and we judged some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and Milai won. And congratulations to her. The kids were great, and it was a toss up to who had the most candy in a peanut butter and jelly. If the category was who put the most candy into a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, it would have been a toss up, because they all put equally too much candy in the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But it was a fun time, and I'm glad that we're still awake. Thank you, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Industry Night, our weekly segment that talks food and hospitality. Last week, Chef Marcel Valladolid was in from the Food Network. The week before that, Jimmy Banas Jr. is talking breakfast. Tonight, we have a twofer. Later in the hour, we'll talk Filipino barbecue with Chef Joaquin Soler, who announced this week that his popular restaurant Smalls in Albany Park would be closing permanently. But first, let's talk mezcal. The smoky cousin to tequila has become all the rage in the world of cocktails, and a new bar in Logan Square has taken it to the next level, celebrating the agave plant, the liquor with the whole bar dedicated to it. Quixote is a mezcal bar and cafe that also serves lunch, brunch, and dinner. The restaurant is named on all sorts of best of 2017 lists. Congratulations, guys. And also, they really brought the distinct flavors of Mexico through mezcal to the Chicago area. In studio tonight, Paul Biasco and Dan Sauls. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us, Justin.
So let's start with, because I have so many questions about your former lives. You know, you ran a food truck, you were in journalism, so I want to get to that, but let's talk mezcal. Am I wrong in saying this is sort of like all the rage? I feel like we've seen almost in a way, and I don't want to generalize, but like tequila kind of take a back seat, and mezcal sort of become the new drink or liquor of choice.
Sure. It's definitely taken off. There's tons of signs. It's being brought to the market differently. Certain companies are starting to align themselves with mezcal now, but it's something we've both loved for a really long time. So we're not really trying to follow any trends there, but we've gone down to Mexico. We've seen it made. And what's really cool about mezcal is that the difference from tequila, that it's always steamed and generally made in a commercialized fashion. Mezcal and certainly ones that we have are all very handcrafted, 100% agave spirits, made without machines, without factories, just guys. I mean, Paul's been down there and he was raking agave in front of a horse.
All right, back us up. I mean, where does mezcal come from? I mentioned the agave plant. Explain where mezcal comes from.
Absolutely. So I think why you're asking why it took off so much is because, you know, this farm to table and people want to know where their food's coming from, literally down to the area. And mezcal specifically on each bottle, they'll tell you down to the single person who made it. So similar to tequila, it's made from an agave plant, but tequila, it's made from all of the same kind of agave, a Blue Weber, but mezcal is made from 30 different kinds. So when you're getting a bottle, it's almost like wine, you know the type of agave that you're drinking. But more importantly, it'll tell you the village where it came from, and that gives it a ton of the flavor like terroir. So a lot of the beverage industry, they're talking about mezcal the same way you're almost talking about wine. You know, you're talking about the variety, you're talking about the terroir, you're talking about the maker. And we're really focused on, you know, highlighting all those three things in the mezcals that we carry. So, you know, our all of our bartenders are extremely knowledgeable on this. We have the makers. And last week we had Aziz Cortez, and who's possibly one of the best mezcal makers in the world, hanging out with our staff, doing some training.
That's great, yeah.
So we're really you know, happy to be able to connect people to the actual producer.
Is there, I mean, is there a real sort of, obviously the way you both explain it, there's an independent spirit that comes to making mezcal. It's not something that, I mean, it can be mass produced, and it has, it is, I'm sure, if you go to the grocery stores and what have you, but there's something special about it that, like you said, is kind of akin to wine.
They all tell a story. Paul alluded to one of the brands that we carry, El Holgorio and Nuestra Soledad. And it's six generations of family members all over different towns in Oaxaca making mezcal. And you can, you know, sometimes mezcals are labeled by region or sometimes by the varietal of the agave itself. And what's really cool is if El Holgorio has an Espadin, which is a more common style of mezcal, the next batch that we buy will be made from his uncle, but the one before that was his grandfather.
Oh.
And it tells these different stories. It gives me goosebumps every time.
Yeah, right. Now, I mean, as I said, for the flavoring, I mean, it does come across as sort of a smoky, I guess, I kind of said it as the simplest way possible, a cousin to tequila.
We hear smoky tequila a lot.
Yeah, but I mean, it's in that family, of course, because of the plant, but the smoke is definitely a part of the flavor.
Yeah, I would say that's a good starting point for a lot of people. And some of the more mass-produced mezcales do have more smoke, but we carry a lot of really small batch stuff that you'd be really surprised doesn't have a huge overriding smoke to it.
Where does that smoke come from then? Why is it in more mass-produced stuff than the independent stuff?
They're roasted over wood. What they do is they get wood from whatever region, whatever they can get. There's different styles, and they'll catch it on fire, and they'll heat up rocks and coals. And then they'll get a bed of very hot rocks. They'll throw all the agave pinas, the hearts of them, into that, and then they'll cover it. And that'll roast it slowly over a couple days.
Okay. Yeah, 3 to 5 days. So that's where you pick up a lot of the smoke. But you know, some of the mezcal that we're talking about, you know, you're going to get vegetal notes. You're going to get minerality. You know, you're going to get salinity. A lot of it's based on, like, the soil or the clay where it's growing in, and that's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, and even down to what sort of plants are growing near the open-air fermenters, whether it was fermented in log or distilled in clay. I mean, it's insane. And we have a book at Quixote that circulates definitely downstairs that Paul and part of his journalism background helped publish. We have this great book that categorizes every mezcal that we have down to the species, what it was distilled in, what it was fermented in, the name of the mezcalero or mezcalera, the ABV, the town, everything.
If I'm coming into Quixote, am I prepared? Should I prepare myself for flights? Should I prepare myself for sampling? How do you, when you're running a mezcal bar and cafe, and there's so many different varietals that you guys are presenting, what's the best way to do that?
It comes down to the knowledge of our staff. I mean, we trained for months before we ever opened. We constantly train. We had Aziz in last week. We've had other makers in. It's constant training. It's a lot of tasting. So there's some perks to the job. We do offer flights, no doubt. We change them all the time. Whether they're grouped by Espadines or whether they're grouped by a certain style of distillation or similar, you know, like pairings or the delineation of flavors. But we also just, you know, you can ask about anyone. We have different mezcals upstairs, downstairs. We sell them out the door. So we've got, like, lots of different ways to get mezcal or in a cocktail.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, what, you know, if you want to be an expert, you want to come in and nerd out, like, you can definitely do that down to the craziest tasting note. But we don't want it to be like, you know, you're coming into a library, you're scared, you're intimidated. Like, it's an open thing. You know, our bartenders are super cool. You may know nothing about it, and, like, we love that. One of the coolest things, I think, is that we have a to-go license. So, you know, you like something behind the bar, you're pretty much, you know, one of only one or two shops in the whole city, maybe the Midwest, that carry these bottles, so you can leave with something, which I think is really
cool. Wow, that's great. Quixote is the Mezcal Bar and Cafe in Logan Square. Paul Biasco and Dan Saul's in studio tonight. We're talking Mezcal. You know, before I let you guys go, I mean, you both have had different careers before Mezcal. Of course, Paul, you referenced your background in journalism. Mm-hmm. You were at DNA Info for a long time. People know your byline. What happened? I mean, what's the shift? You got out of writing stories about politics in the neighborhoods?
I know.
And got into booze, huh?
I love DNA Info. I used to work at the Daily Herald covering crime, and I went to DNA Info doing the neighborhood thing. All the while, Dan, I was kind of helping him in the background on a lot of things, and we were always, you know, kind of shooting around this idea of doing a big project, and he finally convinced me over like a 6-year period.
Yeah, I caught him in a weak point. Caught him at a low point. I was just finishing up my tenure with the garage and the salsa truck, and.
So you had been in other restaurants, but you also had a popular food truck, the salsa food truck.
Yeah.
So talk about it. I mean, has it always been owning and operating a food truck is the dream to have a brick and mortar space, or is it not worked that way?
It totally depends. Mine was definitely a means to an end. I was, you know, my foot in the door. I was completely willing. I always wanted to be in restaurants. I wanted to be a chef for whatever that's worth and go from there. But, and I was always willing to, like, if I had to start as a dishwasher and work my way up and do that kind of stuff. But, fortunately the city of Chicago was changing laws. I actually, right after college, was a stockbroker and didn't like it. And right when it seemed like the city was, starting to, allow food trucks.
Yeah.
I just got caught by the bug.
What's the difference? I mean, for you to be in a cafe and a bar with lunch, brunch, food, and also Mezcal, I mean, what's the big challenge or what's the big difference between operating a food truck and being in the restaurant business?
Well, I'd say operating a food truck was the single hardest experience of my life, especially doing it by myself. I had great friends and staff and people to help, but taking all of that on, being a self-proprietor, definitely prepared me for the restaurant. I'm crazy. I like to work a lot. So that definitely plays into it. But, I mean, we have a huge staff. We have different menus. We open early in the morning. Then we have lunch. Then we transition to dinner. We have a downstairs bar. We have late-night food. We've got a patio. There's a lot going on.
That's a lot. Yeah, right.
Menus, lots of staff. Managing staff is
Do you find – yeah, I was going to say, that's the two things. I mean, management, but you also find yourself – is the time different? I mean, is the idea that now that you're in this space, this brick-and-mortar space, I mean, you were with the garage as well, but do you find that more time that you spend in the space than you did with the truck?
Yeah, because this one's 7 days. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, we open at 9 a.m. every day, and it goes till 2 or 3, so
it's a lot of time.
Now, I make the transition to journalism. I mean, you'll be following stories and running deadlines, but your hours aren't usually that crazy.
No, but I will say, like... journalism's kind of a 24/7 job because even if I'm not working, I'm pretty much on the internet reading like what's going on in the city. I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm nuts. I'll hear an ambulance go by and I'll flip on my scanner still, even now. So it's kind of the same, you know. I'm checking emails. I'm doing this. If I'm not at the restaurant, pretty much just thinking about it at every moment. So in that sense, it's the same.
Yeah, we really like. Being independent and working for ourselves is a huge part of it. Like, we ask for this. We have nothing to complain about the hard hours or anything like that. It's, I mean, one day I think we'd both like to like, retire in Mexico or something like that. But it's a long ways away. So we're young and dumb. And just,
Paul, what
you know,
was it?
Baby.
I mean, I asked Dan this question about the challenges and the differences. You know, when you talk about journalism, I mean, obviously time was a mm-hmm. big part of it, but... But how different is the restaurant business to telling stories of crime and whatever specific beat you're on?
I would say the things that I think it prepared me to do were just work with people. They're both jobs where you're going to encounter 20 different people in a day, all kinds of people. I used to walk into someone's home after a crime. I used to interview a politician. I used to interview a new business owner. And you kind of need to be able to handle all of those situations and kind of relate to all those people. And through journalism, I think you really learn how to do that, no matter how old they are, young they are, et cetera. And the same thing happens at the restaurant. You know, I'm there every dinner. People come in the front door. I meet 30, 40 people every night. And the coolest thing is, you know, we got a ton of regulars already. know most of them by name. You know, I know where they
Paul's
like
the
set.
Man of the people.
It's, yeah, it's the same thing. It's funny. I tell people, I'm like, it's the exact same thing.
He's a legend in Logan Square.
No, 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 no.
What's the address?
2456 North California Avenue.
2456 North California. Quixote is the restaurant, Mezcal Bar and Cafe, with lunch, brunch, and dinner. You can find that. If you search Quixote, you get all the best lists, best restaurants, things like that for 2017. Paul Biasco, Dan Sahls in studio talking Mezcal, but also their transition from one area to the next. Guys, thanks so much for being here, and congrats on your success.
Thank you so much.
All right, we got, like I said, an industry night twofer tonight coming up after the Rob Martier news. We're going to talk with chef owner Joaquin Soler, who is the chef owner of Small's Barbecue in Albany Park, which just put the announcement out that they are permanently closing the space. They had already put out one that was sort of a temporary close, like, we'll be back. We're just fixing some stuff. And it's turned to a permanent close. Which have you, Pete, are you a fan of that place?
I've never been.
Oh, so good. A lot of the chicken was amazing. Everything about it. I mean, it was a like I said, I mean, I was living in the West Loop on Madison Street. So that's zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're on Irving. So I would go all the way to Irving, and I would essentially grab the Kennedy and fly up to Irving because it would be like a Saturday night or something like that. Wait in the line that usually stretched around the corner. Get the food, but there was nowhere to eat it because there was only five seats. Mm-hmm. And some people would get savvy, and they had a deal with the bar on the corner that you could eat the food there while you drank their beer. But I would just get back in the car and just hop back on the expressway. And I'm like, maybe with the gas mileage and everything that the traffic, and it may probably not the most efficient way to get your food, but it was so good. So
I'd have to get two orders because I'd have to have a car order. And then, at, like, when you get home, you can't come home with. You have to have something
That's
to
right.
come home
That's
to,
right.
you know.
Exactly. And also tonight, coming up in Studio 435, Show You Suck is here. Very excited to have him back. He was one of our first, I feel like he was in the first couple months that we were on.
Mm-hmm.
He came through. We talked about his career. Independent hip-hop artist here in Chicago who also, I just was talking to him in one of the breaks, Air Credits, which is his project that he's doing with Hood Internet, mm-hmm. another guest that's been on the show, is awesome. You know, I've seen it here and there, and I've seen it on Twitter, and I haven't had a chance to actually dig in. You know, to use the parlance of our times, I slept on it. And I shouldn't have. I listened today. I was listening to all his music, and I was listening to that particular album that came out, I think it is right around in the wintertime. It's great. The Hood Internet, one of my favorite DJ collectives of all time. Great stuff. They've been working for over a decade now. And to mix with Show You Suck is awesome. And he's rapping on top of their stuff. It's awesome. So anyway, he's live in studio tonight.
Awesome.
How great is that?
I know.
So that's coming up. Rob, where's the longest, what's the longest you would go for carry out?
For carry out?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I, Chef Soler, who's coming up next, I was living in the West Loop, so I was down in Madison Street, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and I would go all the way up to Irving and Albany Park. What was it, cross street there? It was like, what's the cross street on Smalls?
Irving and Albany, but Irving and Kedzie, basically.
Irving and Kedzie. Okay. So I'd flow up there on a Saturday to get his food to take it back home. That's like 50 blocks.
That's a long way, man.
That's a long way. That's an express. There's an expressway in that commute.
I'd say I do an hour round trip.
There you go.
Max. All right. You know, I'd come down. Like if I really had a hankering, for instance, mm-hmm. for Twin Anchors ribs.
Oh, right,
by the way, I'm not a spokesperson for Twin Anchors. I would come down for Twin Anchors ribs.
You would. You'd bring them back home.
And the thing is that I'd order like three slabs. So I'd make it worth my while.
That's what Pete said. You need a car order.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest, just put on Facebook that his restaurant was closing for good. I'm talking about chef owner Joaquin Soler and his awesome spot, Small's Barbecue. The Filipino barbecue joint in Chicago's Albany Park neighborhood was a huge hit when it came on the scene in June of 2013. The restaurant had only 5 seats, so people would drive far and wide, me included, to essentially get carryout. Tonight, an industry night twofer. Because in studio, chef owner Joaquin Soler, this winter, of course, Small's closed temporarily.
Yes.
It was trying to reconcept equipment, things of that nature. But this week, the news became permanent. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is a big blow for me. You know, I enjoyed it, and I thought it was one of the better restaurants in Chicago. So thanks for bringing that to us. What's happening? What's happening to the restaurant? Why did this week you decide to permanently close it?
You know, I think it was just, you know, when we first opened Small's, it was kind of on a lark. Let's just see what happens when all we have is good food, or what we think is good food, what we like to eat. And we open up in, and no offense to Irving Park or Albany Park neighborhood, but for all intents and purposes, it's not, you know, Randolph Row. It's not Fulton Market. It's none of those places.
It's a neighborhood.
In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
In basically a converted coach house, a converted garage, and just see what happens. And it happened.
I mean, knowing that, and before we get into the happen, because it did happen. But, I mean, when you start out taking on a coach house or a converted garage, like you said,
yes,
and you said, let's just see what happens. I mean, do you have, when you start putting the business plan together, you're like, if we get 20 people, we'll be successful. I mean, were you thinking about the arc of what was success for Small's?
Absolutely. We were looking at, we were looking at break evens and all the, you know, the regular numbers and projections that you look at, you know, throwing darts at a board and all that, trying to figure out what would work. And really what it boiled down to was that essentially what it was going to become was a proof of concept. It was a stepping stone to something else. We did not expect it to become what it became very quickly. And, you know, it was great. It was absolutely fantastic. One of the best experiences of my life. It's really bittersweet for me to have had to make the decision to shut it down. And I love my landlady. She and I have a great relationship. She was super supportive of everything we were doing. And, you know, but it was just time. It's 480 square feet. And
small place.
Yes. And that menu, and it's not a large menu by any means, but again, it's 480 square feet. That was all we had. There was no storage. There's no basement. The 480 square feet includes the bathroom. That was it. And we made, besides bread and a couple of other little things, we made everything in-house. And we're just bumping into each other. It was craziness.
When did you know? I mean, was it right from the get-go when you said Small's is opening in 2013, June of 2013? Did you know that there would be a rush on the food, that this would be something different than what you expect?
We had no idea. Of course, you don't go into something thinking it's going to be a failure, right? You're always hoping for success. But we had no clue what was going to happen. And that's not to say that it stayed that way, that it stayed like crazy busy the entire time. But we definitely got caught with our pants down.
When did you recognize that there was, that your pants were firmly around your ankles?
The Tribune did a story on us. I want to say it was in July. And they did this story, and it was great. They did it on my partner and I and Small's and, you know, all these same kinds of questions, quite frankly. And talking about the different menu items, the fried chicken, the brisket, the bibimbap, the sauces, all that. And it was great. You know, nice picture, nice write-up in the food section. Really flattering. I believe it came out on, when's the food section? On Wednesdays?
Yeah, right.
So it comes out on Wednesday. You know, Wednesday night comes. Okay. A little bump. Nothing major. So we're like, okay, cool. We can deal with this. You know, we can hang. Thursday night, bigger bump. Okay, we can deal. We'll go to Restaurant Depot. We'll pick some more stuff up. Friday comes, and it was just ridiculous.
Line down the block,
and it was, my staff was terrified, you know. But at that point, we'd only been open for, you know, 6 weeks maybe. And it was, you know, we had, you know, you always open with a bigger staff. And it's a bigger staff in a 480 square foot space. It was insane. And then Saturday happened. And that was just lights out.
Absolutely. I have to say, insane. I mean, for the amount of times, and I guess it probably was 2013, 2014, that I would be going up there. Every time I went up there, it was Friday or Saturday night, there was a line to get in. There was a line around the corner. There was,
yes.
I mean, so, I mean, you were able to sustain it. How, with the space that you're talking about, and a lot of the reasons why you're closing up shop now.
Right.
How are you able to do things for 3 years or 3.5 years at that same sort of space and pace?
You know what? We looked at it this way. We looked at it as always attempting to manage everyone's expectations, whether it is, you know, whether it was my business partners or my staff, my kitchen people, my dishwasher, my front of the house folks, my customers. Always managing expectations. You know, we never made any claims about being the best this or the best that. We weren't the best fried chicken, weren't the best brisket, weren't the best brisket bibimbap. We're the only brisket bibimbap. But, you know, we never made any claims like that. But one thing we always did was, you know, and we always try to do is just manage those expectations. We are not fast food. If you're going to order chicken, it's going to take a while. We have one fryer. You know, and we, you know, again, you know, as time goes on, you learn to work in that space. You learn different efficiencies, figure out different SOPs to make things happen a little bit better and maintain quality. And that was fantastic. But I think at the end of the day, you know, especially with the reconcept, which I'm super excited about.
We're going to talk about that, yeah.
You know, I need to be able to manage my own expectations. And that I wasn't able to manage that anymore in that space.
That's a great point. I mean, when you are tasked with the idea of managing everybody else's expectations,
right,
whether it be your partners or your customers or your staff, is it a hard task to manage your own?
Yes, it can be. It's just one of the many challenges of owning your own business, and particularly of owning your own restaurant.
Did you want to push? Did you feel like, you know, when all this was happening and you had to manage expectations in your own way and managing your own, were you satisfied where you were? Do you want to push further? Do you want more crowd? Like, what was going through your mind when this, which, and the reason we get into this area is that it's not necessarily the status quo for restaurant openings and especially ones at the size that you were talking about.
Right.
Usually there might be a bit and then they'll come down or maybe right. Get a weekend kind of stuff. But how, I mean, talk about like what was going through your mind as you were having this, not only success, but just, I would assume, a lot of stress.
You know, what went through my mind was maintaining the quality. How do we maintain quality? You know, how do we make sure that this fried chicken, and the only reason the fried chicken was on the menu is because I love fried chicken.
It was a hard thing to mass produce.
Yes, and I just wanted a place close to my house. At the time, I lived in Lincoln Square. And there was no fried chicken around. I'm like, you know what? We're going to do this barbecue thing. Let's throw some fried chicken on the menu. Let's do that. And, you know, I just did this, you know, this version of my mother's fried chicken that I grew up eating. And, you know, but you need to figure out how to maintain that quality. It needs to taste exactly the same way every time,
right.
Day in, day out. Somebody comes in there for lunch. They come in for dinner. It needs to taste exactly the same. If they came in 2 years ago and they're back, needs to taste exactly the same. And that became the challenge. And that was always, that's always my challenge. That's always my biggest, I guess, stressor,
yeah,
if you will, when it comes to just the food itself. You know, we figured out how to make it.
But how do you keep it consistent?
Exactly.
Right. Chef owner Joaquin Soler, the chef owner of Small's Barbecue Place up in Chicago's Albany Park, Irving Park neighborhood.
Yes.
Irving and Kedzie. Longtime favorite that this week just closed for good. You know, before we get into the next project, where does the food come from? You just mentioned your mom and making the fried chicken that your mom used to make.
Yes.
I mean, that was what was so great about the food is it was this Filipino barbecue joint, which was very specific and very, you know, people just didn't have that in Chicago.
Right.
Where's the food come from?
My house. Basically, we moved here. My family and I moved here when I was 8 years old. And we moved to Hyde Park directly from Manila. And we were always, you know, before the word foodie existed, we were always into food. Like growing up in Manila, it was all about food, what restaurant was opening, what you know, what mom was cooking, what our cousins were cooking. It was always about food. And, you know, you move to Chicago and you're in Hyde Park. And at the time, Hyde Park wasn't as developed. And we would just kind of explore. So my dad and I would go, you know, they opened an art gallery in Lincoln Park. And we ended up, you know, just driving through and you see this little barbecue stand. Okay, let's go in there. Let's check out Leon's. Let's check out, you know, whatever other, you know, there was one other place. What was it that I saw in the Frugal Gourmet that my dad ended up taking me to? I think it was called Edith's in the West Side. And all she did were ribs. And, you know, we're Filipino, though. So you get this stuff home. Well, we're not going to eat it with French fries. Well, French fries, too. Why not? But rice and vegetables and all these different things, you know, all these different things that we grew up eating. It was just this natural. Right. It just worked so well. And it's how I've always kind of eaten. It's just kind of like this amalgamation. No chef is cooking what they cook at their like fancy schmancy restaurant at home. Right. You know, you look in a chef's fridge, it's probably going to be, you know, slim, a lot of condiments. And for us, it was just kind of like that. You know, it's takeout and then you just kind of make all these different, you know, you just kind of piece it all together.
Did you find yourself, I mean, you're experimenting or, you know, going on adventures to different places. Did you find yourself gravitating to Filipino places in Chicago? I can't even think of where there would be. I know that there's markets, but I'm trying to think of where there would be restaurants that would be cooking sort of authentic Filipino food.
You know, there have always been a ton of Filipino restaurants in Chicago. Maybe not a ton, but there's definitely a decent amount in Chicago and the suburbs and all that. But they're always for other Filipinos, you know, and Filipino food has taken a while to kind of, you know, to get to the forefront. So, you
what's
know,
what is the main ingredients of a Filipino cuisine?
Oh my goodness, that's really hard to
nail.
No,
and I feel like I should know this because we had people in talking about it one time. Right. And it's just now I've just completely spaced it.
You know, it's rice.
Yeah.
You know, rice is a big part of a Filipino meal. There's this misconception here that Filipino food's all about meat. It's very like meat, like pork centric and beef centric and all these other things. Actually, it isn't. It's really all about rice and smaller portions of meat, smaller portions of certain vegetables, of fish, things like that. Those are the staples. And all those different components are really richly flavored, big, punchy flavors, salty, sour, bitter, sweet, spicy in some areas. And they're really flavorful because they're meant to flavor the rice.
Ah, okay.
Okay, when you sit down to eat a Filipino meal, it's not coursed out. Everything besides dessert, and in some places dessert comes out too, everything just kind of comes. And you combine it. It's this fun little process of kind of, you know, constructing the perfect bite of food. You know, so I remember growing up, there's this one soup, sinigang, which I never really cared for as a little kid. And my mom showed me, if you take a spoonful of rice and you dip it in the soup and then you eat it. And I remember that was just this like huge like moment for me, like, oh my God, this is awesome.
So as you know, we've been teasing out this entire segment, the idea that Smalls may be closing for good, but the reason it's doing that is that there is a reconcept on the table. Did you try to put that reconcept into Smalls, or was the idea that just never was going to happen? Because early on you were like, we're closing temporarily for a reconcept, we're closing because of equipment and stuff. Was the idea first to put something else into the small space, or was that just sort of, we need time to think about this?
We kind of wanted a little of both. We wanted to play around with it. You know, I was talking earlier about quality and trying to maintain it. And Filipino food, at least the type of food that we were starting to do at Smalls, is perfect for that. It holds really well. We figured out some different techniques that aren't necessarily traditional to Filipino kitchens that we were starting to employ that were working beautifully for the food. But then again, it became this thing of like,
we don't have any space here. Yeah.
Right. We're getting busier and busier. And it was just, I didn't want the wheels to fall off. And I wanted to just cut it off before that happened. We want to do it right. And Filipino food is very near and dear to me. You know, I didn't, growing up, I'm not going to lie, growing up in Manila, I did not like it at all. I didn't care for it. I wanted American food. I wanted German food, Italian food, all these different, French food, all these different things, Spanish food, never Filipino food. When we'd go out to dinner and my, you know, my mom and my brother and my sisters would want Filipino food, they'd go to this one restaurant called The Grove. My dad and I would drop them off there And then we'd go to, like, the real restaurant. And he and I would have, like, our little father-son date eating, like, you know, whatever, at the tapas at the Spanish place, or right. schnitzel at this right. one German
Spaghetti.
Place. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, right.
You know, and then when I moved here, and I always like certain Filipino dishes, and then moving here, you just kind of start to yearn for it. You know, it tastes like home.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so we
so what? So what are we going to get? What are you working on? Tell us what you can tell us.
Well, right now we're working on a ton of different things, actually. So right now we're looking for spaces, and we're developing that. We're developing some of the sauces we use at Smalls. And then we're also partners in a farm up in Michigan, in Galeen, Michigan, where we've been working there for the past like 3 years or so. Some of the produce we were using at Smalls
All right.
was coming from that farm. We've been kind of like distributing it a little bit here and there to different restaurants in Chicago, some buddies of mine.
If you find the right space.
Yes.
Let's say you find a restaurant space that's 4,800 feet as opposed to 480. If you reconcept, you put a restaurant, is it Smalls again? Is it a different name? I mean, what do you do as a restaurateur to move into a new space?
One thing I've learned for myself, I operate best with limitations. And it's really, a lot of it's going to be contingent upon that space and mm-hmm. that neighborhood. You know, I may be dying to open a Filipino place, but there's certain neighborhoods where I just wouldn't do that. You know, somebody, one of my old customers was telling me about a space that opened up in Streeterville. I'm like, yeah, I don't know if we're going to be doing that Filipino concept in Streeterville. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe one day. We'll see. You know. But
so I think if you have to change the concept of the restaurant and make it all meat and you just bring cards out when you want more, then that's Streeterville. You're ready to go.
Exactly. There you go.
But I mean, so yeah, it's the contingent upon the restaurant, but is the idea that to continue the sort of flavor palette and the stuff that you were doing, the barbecue stuff that you were doing at Smalls in a new space?
I'll tell you this. I would love to do both, and they don't necessarily have to happen in the same space.
All right.
And I would love to stay in Chicago, but I need to be open-minded. But there's definitely some neighborhoods in Chicago that I think would work beautifully for a Filipino space. And that definitely is something, like I said, that's the one I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
A lot of that might be for purely selfish reasons. I've grown tired of smelling like smoke every day. maybe I want to come home and smell like shrimp paste and fish sauce for a little bit.
A lot of different smells that you can get into.
Exactly. Right?
Well, when you do find a space, whether it's here in Chicago or not, you got to come back and we'll talk about the restaurant opening and that kind of thing.
We'd love to do that.
Chef owner Joaquin Soler, who's the chef owner of Smalls, which just permanently closed this week, the famed barbecue restaurant in Chicago's Irving Park neighborhood, Albany Park neighborhood. We're seeing what's next, and that's what we're talking about here on Industry Night. Joaquin, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Yeah, I hope that Chef Soler puts it somewhere. You know, that's great to have a Filipino restaurant like that. And Smalls was amazing, so it'd be interesting to see what happens. Coming up, Studio 435 tonight, live in studio right here on Michigan Avenue. Show You Suck, the independent hip-hop artist who just came off a tremendous... I know it's tremendous because I saw it all over Instagram. I didn't see it, but it was like I might as well have been there to watch him on stage at the Logan Square Arts Festival this weekend. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get the news, and then we'll have live Studio 435. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Last week, we had the indie rock band Mooner. This week, the week before that, the dream pop music of Panda Riot. Before that, blues with Billy Branch. You can hear all the live sets at WGNradio.com. You can just search Studio 435. Tonight, the indie hip-hop sounds of Show You Suck. Show You Suck returns to the download this last week in my Instagram feed. was jammed with photos and video from his great performance at the Logan Square Arts Festival. Show You Suck has been a staple in the Chicago music community for years now, and his newest collaboration called Air Credits pairs him with Chicago favorite DJ collective The Hood Internet. He's got a new solo record coming out this summer called Vacation Forever. Show You Suck's next big gig, The Taste of Chicago. He'll be at the Bud Light stage on July 5th. Show You Suck in studio tonight. Good to see you.
Hola, ¿cómo estás? I'm back.
How you been?
I've been amazing. How about yourself?
Good, good. It's great to have you back this time. We'll play some music, some live music. You know, what does it mean to you to be on stage at, the Summer Festival? Because the last time we talked to you, I think you were doing Wicker Park Fest or one of those.
I think it was Riot Fest last time I was here?
But regardless, This is fest season for you to get up on stage at the street festivals. Tell me about that. Tell me about how that works for you as a hip-hop guy.
I am so blown away. I still can't believe that I'm playing The Taste of Chicago. There's some things in rap that I achieve, and there's some level of not expectancy, but I'm not totally caught off guard because I somewhat willed it into existence.
Right.
This was a thing that I didn't even have on my radar at all. Playing The Taste of Chicago was something that I never even conceived that I would be doing. And even in the part that's even more amazing to me is the fact that I haven't put out a solo album in so long. And I got this show without even having a solo album out. So it just shows the love I get from the city.
I want to ask you about that because you've guested on a lot of stuff, and mm-hmm. I mentioned Air Credits and other things. So you're constantly busy.
Yeah,
you have work even if you're not putting out your solo material. Talk about how the music, your music, the industry that surrounds you has changed in the way that you don't have to put out a solo record to be noticed. You're on tracks. You're able to put stuff out. You're on other people's stuff. I mean, there'd be a time, and maybe even in your career mm-hmm. where if you're not putting out music, your own solo, people forget about you.
Yeah.
In this case, that's not happening.
No, I within the past about a year and a half, I kind of come under a new ideology with my music career, and is that I don't treat it like a music career. I just kind of treat myself like a working artist, like a hired gun, I guess, so to speak. Like, people just book me to do weird things, and I just make weird things and put weird things out. As much creativity I put out in the universe, good things will come back and opportunities will come back to me. So that's how I play it. I don't play it with, I don't do album cycles. It's not about album rollouts like other artists
do. You approach the art in a different way by doing that?
I just do whatever I want. I create what I want to create, and that's the rule I live by. That is it. And I've learned that as long as I create and it's stuff that I want to do and things that I'm excited about, then opportunities will come, and that's where the money bag comes. So I don't chase the money. I just make what I want to make, and then the bills get paid.
That's a great creative.
Yeah, it's a cool life. Yeah. It's a really cool life. I don't take it for granted. I know everyone else isn't able to live like this at the current moment, but I feel like everyone has the ability to live how they want to live.
You know, I think about, I have a lot of artists on, people who are celebrities, other people who are in the in Hollywood or maybe on Broadway, places like that, even the music career. But they'll talk about, it's great to be on, I got this great role, this, that, and the other. But it's a 6-month gig.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to turn around and they have to audition again and have to get back into it. I mean, is music similar in that regard? You talked about the
I've
solo
even done
records.
Some. I've done some auditioning for some acting gigs, and I've done some voiceover work in the past year. I've kind of done a bit of everything in the past 2 years, and I got a taste of everything. And I just learned that I have to have a hand and some of everything. I say yes to just about every opportunity that comes my way, and it leads me in. And even if I get asked to audition for this movie role and I don't get the movie role. It always happens. Right. It never, ever, ever fails. It never fails. So I just learned to say yes to things and come in with a sunny disposition. And
how do you
things
learn
work
that?
Out.
I guess as,
experience.
As an artist, I mean, there are times in your life where maybe you weren't as, you didn't have sunny disposition, or maybe you were upset about the
Hey, idea. There's ups and downs, and I get bummed out about things even now. I'm a human being, and it's okay. We have to learn how to accept all of our emotions, live through them, but you have to know that tomorrow is coming. So, I can be bummed out for a day, but I know that it's just going to be for that day, and I'm going to get back to what I'm doing the following day, because I can't dwell in it. But I've learned a lot from one experience, and also just watching artists ahead of me. Mm-hmm. I've seen artists come and be a-holes and lose opportunities. So I see the perception, you know, I can see things from both angles. I feel like, you know, I'm a 32-year-old man and I've experienced life. So I have to act like I've learned some things. Like I don't have no excuse to walk through here and not know what's going on. I know what it looks like to act Hollywood, and I've seen people go from the bottom to the top and drop again. So I'm not going to be one of those.
Did those experiences, did they ultimately help you as a lyricist, as someone who's writing lyrics? Like you said, you're a 32-year-old man who's, you've lived a life. I mean, it's almost like thinking mm-hmm. about writers, novelists who, you know, live their life till 30 yeah. and then they start writing. The idea, like, I mean, but
that
but
is as so
a,
real.
But like as a lyricist, as a rapper, I mean, do you find more depth in the work that you're doing the more you live your life?
Absolutely, 100%. 100%. I find more purpose in my work now. Due to the current times that we're in, I find a lot more purpose in being an artist. And I've learned that I don't have to pigeonhole myself into one type of thing. That's why I have the side project Air Credits. Which is me kind of trying more my hand at more political work mm-hmm. In my own type of way. So
I think it's the first climate change based rap project I've known.
I'm a bet on that. Yeah, there's some. I feel like there's some inklings of it in some like some older Busta Rhymes work.
Okay, don't want to sell Busta short.
But, no, yeah, but I'll take that for sure. Absolutely. It's like a full on like sci-fi rap album.
Yeah, it's great. It's a tremendous, tremendous achievement for you guys doing that. When you sort of delve into an area when you're talking about science fiction or being more political and climate, is that come easy for you as an artist? I mean, that's not necessarily how I know your work.
Exactly.
So how is it to transition? To
it
that?
Was. I don't know. I guess it was easy. It was kind of easy, but it was. I was unsure with. I'm still kind of unsure with how people were going to perceive it. It didn't stop me from putting it out or stop me from doing it, but it was just something to think about, yeah. You know. But writing material it's not difficult for me at all, because we've been lucky enough to be able to build this universe around the music, and it's just another case of I can kind of make the art I want to make, and as long as it has the fun spirit that people know that comes from me, no matter what the message is, I think people perceive it pretty well. Yeah. As long as I sell it, as long as I like full-heartedly do it, people get into it.
And there's something to be said about it. I mean, half of great hip-hop is marketing. And I don't mean marketing like going on a street and handing people flowers, but or flyers, but the idea of selling it, of being that person, being that
yeah,
persona.
I believe in what I do, fully.
So that's what you're selling, right?
Yeah.
You know, for you, and I've known your work for a long time, it feels like you have, I mean, if you're do with the side project and you got the solo project coming out, how do you see your music evolving? How do you see yourself getting more mature? As you, like you said, you're 32-year-old now. Like, what do you see as the differences to the new music?
I've opened myself up a lot more to oddly enough, I've always collaborated a lot, but how I collaborate now is opening up. I'm allowing more input. And how I used to collaborate a lot was like, someone handles beat, I handle words. But now the worlds are kind of coming together. I'm not above letting someone throw me a rap line and I build off of that. Or, you know, or like someone's building a synth line, I kind of go over there and kind of add something there. So now what people are hearing in my music is me learning kind of new things and new techniques. With a lot of the new material from the Air Credits material and the new solo work that's coming out this summer.
Well, we'll talk about that solo work. And I also want to talk about just the writing process. Show You Suck, in studio, indie hip hop artist here in Chicago. Like I said, the new album comes out this summer, Vacation Forever. His next gig, Taste of Chicago, on July 5th at the Bud Light Stage. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Live music, Studio 435. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN, Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. In studio tonight, the indie hip-hop sounds of Show You Suck. Second time here on the download. First time performing. He's got a new album out this summer. His big gig coming up, A Taste of Chicago. It's going to be at the Bud Light stage on July 5th. We're going to hear some music now. Mike Jackson, Professor Fox in the house. and Show You Suck on the mic. Here is the track Cool off the upcoming album Vacation Forever. Take it away, guys.
You can get free clothes, free shows, and sometimes there's free food too. And man, that's cool. Rapping is cool. We can watch the same TV shows all day while in the same room. And yeah, that's cool. My boo is so cool. Move into a brand new place and it's free Wi-Fi out the blue. And yeah, that's cool. Free internet is cool. The free Wi-Fi really ain't free. The connection next door is unsecure. And that's still cool. Still an internet is cool. Order hard shell, order soft shell, and I order cinnamon twist too. Because it's so good. Taco Bell is so good. Cool. With a cool rush. Way back in seventh grade, I was weird. Cause my favorite wrestler was Goldust. Nowadays, all you need is trust, huh? Nowadays, all you need is us, huh? If you need it, then you got it. Yeah. We only being honest, ain't here to make a profit. Being rad is the target. Nothing's really promised, every day go the hardest. Wasn't really sure if I would be an artist, so I wasted hella bread on college. I ain't paying that, Lord, I ain't paying that. If you hate it in the past, this is payback. Yeah. Shot town, homie, this is my town. West side, where the crib at? Shot town, homie, this is my town. West side, where the crib at? Shot town, homie, this is my town. Bellwood, that's the crib, bruh. Gotta stay cool. Hey, gotta stay cool, yeah. Whoa. Gotta stay cool, yeah. Hey, gotta stay cool, yeah. Whoa. Gotta stay cool, yeah. Hey, gotta stay cool, yeah. Gotta stay cool, yeah. Hey, gotta stay cool, yeah. Hey, girls are cool. Moms are cool. Rap is cool. You're cool too. Hey, world peace is real cool. Yeah, world peace is real cool. Yeah, world peace is real cool. Yeah, equality is real cool. Yeah, Trump ain't cool. Nah, hey, Trump ain't cool. Nah, too hot need to cool down. Too hot need to cool down. Hey, Trump ain't cool. Nah, hey, Trump ain't cool. Nah. Too hot, need to cool down. Too hot, need to cool down. Hey, hey, you ain't for rules. Hey, hey, too cool for you. Hey, hey, don't play by rules. I'm too cool for you. I'm don't play by rules. I'm too cool for you. Don't play by rules. You can do it. You can do it too. I'm too cool for school. I'm too cool for
you.
Hey, I'm too cool for you. 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 And you can do it too. Hey.
That was real pretty.
Hey, all right. All right, Hip Hop Sounds of Show You Suck in studio tonight. He's going to be at the Taste of Chicago in the Bud Light stage on July 5th. Come on back up to the microphone. That was a song, Cool, in studio. Mike Jacks, Professor Fox with Show You Suck. That was off the new album, Vacation Forever, which is coming out this summer. So, I mean, as we're going to go to the news in just a second here, and we'll play some more music in the second half, which I'm looking forward to. I mean, that's a good example of the stuff that we'll hear on the new record.
Yeah. On the new album, every song is actually completely different from each other.
Really?
Yeah.
By design? Is that a design thing, or that's just the way it worked out?
I guess it was kind of by design. This album is, the focus of this album is just a good time. It isn't any focus on sort of it being a story from beginning to end. With me working on the Air Credits project, and it's so conceptual. This album is kind of a departure from that, and just more so about like making the biggest songs, the biggest, coolest songs with a rad message, with different people in the room. Yeah.
Is that, will you see more collaboration on this record?
I come back to longtime collaborators like Mike Jacks and Professor Fox. Nick Ketchdubs is on the project. There's also some Hood Internet on the project. Trying to think what else we got on there. Jay Arthur from the Whoevers, who's just going by Jesse now. We have a great record called F That Diet. Let's Eat Some Pizza.
great record.
Yeah. There's another great record called Mentally Healthy with that features another rapper named Big Dipper. There's just really okay. Big, awesome, like cool, positive songs.
Well, here's some more coming up. The album is called Vacation Forever. Show You Suck's next big gig will be Taste of Chicago coming up on the 5th of July in the Bud Light stage. He's here, of course, with Mike Jackson, Professor Fox as well. We'll get some more live music here on Studio 4:35 coming up right after Rob's news. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 4:35 tonight. Chicago rapper Show You Suck in studio. It's going to be a Taste of Chicago coming up on the 5th at the Bud Light stage. He's got a new album coming out called Vacation Forever. We're going to hear some more music from that album. This track is called Crocs or Nah. And Mike Jacks, Professor Fox on the beat. So take it away. Show You Suck.
This next song is about being comfortable with your life. It's called Crocs or Nah.
My world ain't based on black or white, it's based on if you wear Crocs or not. My world ain't based on black or white, it's based on if you wear Crocs or not. Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Do you wear Crocs or not? Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Do you wear Crocs or not? Black and white ain't a thing on my campaign. How you spend your days? Feeling rather lame. How you getting paid? Get yourself a raise. Living life like it's golden, call it well appraised. Get it how you need to get it, I respect to keep your self-esteem more than average.
Keep it more than average.
Watching Clueless while I think about my passions. Now I get to sharing with the masses.
Sharing with the masses.
Cold-blooded, yeah, that's cold-blooded. Yeah. When you're feeling good about it, but then nobody want it. Cold-blooded, yeah, that's cold-blooded. When they say you're out of water, but the whole block flooded. Game change for yourself, in the cartridge. Spending lanes in the pit, keep the cool motion. Feeling stuck nowadays, but you got the options. Getting rad is a crime, I'ma need Cochran. My world ain't based on black or white, it's based on if you wear Crocs or nah. My world ain't based on black or white, it's based on if you wear Crocs or nah. Are you comfortable? Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Do you wear Crocs or nah? Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Are you comfortable?
Huh?
Do you wear Crocs or nah? Now this is the first rap song ever made about wearing Crocs and being comfortable with your life. If there's something that you're doing right now, there's something that you're trying to do with your life right now, you can't do it, go for it. All you got to do is do it. Quit what you're doing right now and make that movement to what you're trying to do with your life. Be comfortable. Wear your pants how you want to wear your pants. Wear your shirts how you want to wear your shirts. If you don't want to wear makeup today, don't wear makeup today. It doesn't matter. It's all about what you want to do. Be comfortable with your decisions. You got the power. Vacation forever. It's about living how you want to live at all times. Vacation forever. Live how you want to live at all times. Vacation forever. Live how you want to live at all times.
Oh my God. My world ain't based on black or white. It's based on if you wear Crocs or not. Nah. My world ain't based on black or white. It's based on if you wear Crocs or not. Nah. Are you comfortable? Huh? Are you comfortable? Huh? Say it, say it. Do you wear Crocs or not? Nah? Are you comfortable? Huh? Are you comfortable? Huh? Do you wear Crocs or not? Nah?
Yeah, look at that.
Be comfortable with your life.
Show You Suck in studio with Professor Fox, Mike Jax. The song was Crocs or Nah. Vacation Forever is the album. They're going to be a Taste of Chicago coming up on July 5th at the Bud Light stage. Come on down to the mic. We'll talk some more. You know, I mean, listening to the music, I mean, how important is it for you as an artist, but also as a lyricist, as a rapper, to work with guys like Mike and Professor Fox? I mean, you can hear the music. You can hear the beats that are being put together. Yeah. I mean, they fit your style to a T.
Yeah. I mean, they're good people. That's first and foremost. I work with good people, and they're really rad dudes. And, like, man, it's just really cool to have relationships with people that, like, trust you.
Right.
Because I'm not the most musically inclined person. I'm not the most super planned person. So these dudes, like, they move, like, man, they come through for me in a clutch, and they're always down to work with me no matter how long of breaks we have in between. And like, it's just, man, they're just a really good home. And like, we just work different. We have like different working relationships with each person. So it's really cool, different experiences when I work with everyone. So I learned so much from these dudes.
You know, as a rapper, I mean, do you find yourself, you know, it's guessing on somebody's stuff or doing a project you say yes to, where you're in situations where you're in different studios or different places, recording with producers that you don't know?
Yeah, definitely. I'm super open to that. When
is that hard for you? Is that hard because you don't have that relationship? Like,
No. I mean, it has its challenges. But I more so look at it for the learning experience and like going, usually there's some rapper that I'm not too familiar with that may hit me up and want to collaborate. And I just say, yes, if they set up the session, I'll show up, and I'm in town, I'll show up, because I always end up learning something. Even Professor Fox, he always hits me up about working with an artist that he's working with, and I don't necessarily know them, and I don't need a lot of information. He just gives me the time and the day, and I show up. And I never know the artist when I show up, and I ended up like, I always end up working with them and learning something really cool from an artist that I never heard of before. So, man, I'm just like at the point in my life where I'm just like a open book more than ever. And I've been making music for a long time. So I want to make it not stale for me. So the best way to do that is just get in the room with some other brains and see what happens.
You can hear, I mean, you've always done this, and I hear it more even with the music we hear tonight, that you're deconstructing the song. So it's not rap, chorus, you know, bridge, rap, you know. I mean, you're messing with the cadences. You're messing with the standard of what we.
Yeah, I love to play with song formats. I think that's
you consider that part of writing?
Yeah, for sure. After a while, you get tired of 16 bars chorus, 16 bars chorus. But there is a time for that also. And a lot of times with songs, sometimes I don't have enough to say on it to have a second verse, and that's okay. Some songs don't need a second verse, and that's fine. Like, I'm the cool thing is I'm always working with people who are open to me being a weirdo about song formats. And that's what's really important for me, that they kind of let me do what I want to do, and I let them do what they want to do in a way.
Well, for you, I think about, you know, as you write songs and you get inspired to put something down, right?
Mm.
Where are you usually at? I mean, are you the kind of guy who is going to just have a light bulb? I'm going to write about Crocs. Here it is right now. Do you have a more disciplined approach to the music? How do you come up with the lyrics that we're hearing in these songs?
It varies a lot of ways. Oftentimes I'm on a couch watching something, and I hear a line in a movie, and it's a really clever line. I was like, oh, that'd be a really cool line to start a rap song off with. A lot of my rap songs, the first lines are lines from movies. And I learned how to twist those and kind of in my sandbox, in my world. There's other times where there's a specific topic that I do want to talk about, and it may be serious, and I go, how do I talk about that within the context that I've built with my other music? So it's kind of, how do I A lot of times I kind of me and Fox do this a lot where we kind of take a reference.
Yeah.
I take a song and then we kind of copy that song. And then we like show you suckify it.
Right.
After we copy it, we deconstruct it. And then like I Weird Al it kind of, you know, Weird Al it kind of.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, yeah.
You call up Fox. You're like, hey, can we Weird Al this?
Yeah.
You know, I think about, you know, because you mentioned that just about the pop culture part of it. That's a lot of your songs start with movie lyrics. And that's something we talked about last time we were in. We talked about, you know, where the inspiration comes for your music. Do you see yourself doing that more or less as you get older? I mean, are you finding yourself writing more particularly about your own things that have happened in your life as you get older? Or are you still sort of going with the concept of watching Alf?
There is more of personal life. The pop culture is still there, but now it's like, how do I take the pop culture and associate it with things that are going on in my life now? Instead of just saying I'm watching Alf, what does this episode of Alf how does this episode of Alf correlate to my life moment? Right. It's kind of more so where I'm at now.
You know, for you, I always think, you know, you got Vacation Forever's coming out. And we'd already talked about how you've got a whole new point of view on your career, where you are a yes-and guy. You took improv classes. You're just yes-and. Anything comes your way, right?
Yep.
Using that philosophy and applying it to a new album, are you going to, the business plan of it change? I mean, do you have different expectations, or does your ambition change when it comes to Vacation Forever because you have a new outlook? I mean, are you a different kind of you have different expectation of what this album's going to do?
Yeah, yeah. Now in my life, the expectation for album is really just I'm just expecting the enjoyment of making it. Really, the reward is really in creating the art now, and not the results of the art. Because when you get wrapped up, you really can't control the results. You really can't. The music business is not based on logic. It's not a A, B equals C. It's not a 1 + 1 = 2 thing. It's not. It's totally not. Some people try to make it seem that way to the public, and I'm telling you, it is not. So now I'm happy with making the art and then performing it and watching people enjoy it.
Did you have to learn that?
I mean, absolutely.
Because there was just too much volatility.
Even still to this day,
the
perception of how artists make it is completely made up. And people lie. They lie about how they get on all the time. And it distorts people who are coming up.
Like how I got here, how I stay here, but there might be already business factors or...
Yeah, 100%. Right, 100%. Right. So you're already kind of expecting things out of this business.
You're buying an image.
Exactly. Right. And I'm just like, I'm not for it. I'm just here. I'm just a hippie, man. I'm just here making tunes, and I just want to put some money in my friends' pockets.
You could
and
be
just...
the first sort of hippie rapper from Chicago. We've had conscious rappers, but maybe...
Right. I'm full on taking charge in that.
I mean, do you still have ambitions to be an artist that plays in that sandbox in the music industry sandbox? If a Def Jam or something came and said, you know what, we love what you're doing, why don't you Priority Records, why don't you come along? I mean, is that something that you think about, or is that not part of your career?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. If anyone comes to me and says I want to help you, then that's something worth talking to. I'm not here to be like anti-label. I'm here for whoever wants to help me create every day. Let's talk.
That's the goal.
Let's hang out. Sit on the couch with me. Let's talk. That's all I'm here for. I'm here to make things. And like, if you come see me at the Taste July 5th, you're going to see an awesomely put together show. I've made a career out of taking really big stages and doing not so normal things with them. And this will be the biggest one yet.
I was going to say, when you approach a stage like Taste of Chicago and you know it's going to be a big thing, I mean, you start thinking months in advance of what you're going to do on that stage to stand out?
I always want to do that. But here's the thing. I'm such a, like, I have to be inspired. for, I think when I found out about it, I hit up these two guys and I was like, oh, let's get ready. And like, we still haven't really like, we still haven't really planned yet because I haven't had the inspiration yet. You know, like I really haven't had the like, what's my message with this set? I haven't had that moment yet.
Get ready for the 3 a.m. text, guys.
That's how it be. And I apologize. You know, I'm not that bad. But like it'll come down to like a couple of days before and it'll be like, Eureka, this is what I want to do.
Give these guys a pager. Give them a beeper so right. they're ready to go when they need
the back signal.
Yeah, right.
But it'll be all good and it'll be huge and grand. I have really big grandiose ideas and like it takes a while for them to materialize, but they always do.
The gig is at Taste of Chicago on July 5th. The Show You Suck's new album, Vacation Forever, out this summer. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll have one more live performance at Studio 435. Show You Suck is in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN, Studio 435 tonight, live music in the All-State Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Show You Suck, the Chicago hip-hop artist in studio. His album, Vacation Forever, is coming out this summer. He's playing Taste of Chicago, the Bud Light stage, on July 5th. He is live tonight, Studio 435 with Mike Jackson, Professor Fox. Let's hear the last track tonight. It is called Drop. Take it away, guys.
Rap song about nothing really. It's just a good time. Whoa. Gone, let it drop.
Hold it now.
Ah. Sipping on a leche, no clam bakes. Cooler than Mel Gibson in the same days. Water World laser disc for the replay. Cop $3, no whammies, it was well appraised. Daria on my arm for the permanent. A lot of funk in the air for the parliament. A sunny Philly always, ass Artemis. N64 blowing the cartridges. Enter offices, incur some overages. I'm a mastermind, you're just a novice. Deluxe apartment machine with the Florences. Bazooka gum, red dot, silencer. Fifth element, big bada boom. Ruby red, super green, love by the tune. Fifth element, big bada boom. Ruby red, super green, please make some room. Gon' let it drop. I'ma let it drop. Gon' let it drop. Hey, I'ma let it drop. Life aquatic with a bouquet, couch, no prom date. If you want it, I'ma serve it like a souffle. Dagger in a trench, black Kuta Kinte. Yeah, don't worry, it's my sweet brother Noonte. A la carte, ambiance, audience. Elder Scroll, Xbox for Oblivion. Your rap's too watered down, my Savion. I'm full, energized, Red Bull in my arms. Yeah. The fastest of cars, bad as a bras. It being yours is all a mirage. Yeah. I've had no flaws since Charles was in Charles. I have more applause than Quick Draw McGraw. Fifth element, big bada boom. Ruby red, super green, love by the tune. Fifth felon bent, bit by the bone. Ruby red, super green, please make some room. Gon' let it drop. My name is Show You Suck. I'm a rapper from Chicago. This is Professor Fox here, and Mike Jacks along with us. This is a rap song about nothing. It's sort of like an episode of Seinfeld. Vacation Forever is the name of the album. Don't forget to love yourself, and don't forget to go out tomorrow and love someone else. When you're stuck in traffic tomorrow, it's not that person in front of you fault. It's not the person on the side of you fault. It's just how the world is. If you get lemons, you gotta make rosé out of them.
Yeah. Listen to that. Yeah. Show yourself in studio tonight.
Yeah.
Performing the track Drop. That was great, man. All right, the album's coming out this summer, Vacation Forever, also playing Taste of Chicago. He'll be at the Bud Light stage on July 5th. You know, as we wrap up tonight, also Mike Jacks, Professor Fox, that was great. Thank you. I have to say, I mean, it's not the particular people walking by the 720, you know, Michigan Avenue space, and they get to see what Mike Jacks has got set up. Hey. I was like, I was taking a picture of it because I wanted to send it to the news guy who sits right in that area in the mornings. You know, so he says, like, "What we do?"
He looked like he time traveled back into like early 1910s and brought a laptop with him.
It looks good. Yeah, for you. I mean, Chicago. Does it matter to you that Chicago is blowing up when it comes in terms of hip hop? I mean,
yeah,
there's so many different.
Absolutely.
Nonstop. Love for this.
Yeah, in any situation where I see creatives thriving, I'm a happy person. I feel like that is one of the catalysts for the world changing in a better way. Creatives,
yeah,
getting creative things off and people perceiving, accepting those things. Yes, I love it. I love it. We need more. We need more.
I mean, it's amazing to me. It's amazing that, I mean, at one point there was, okay, you know, an independent scene here in Chicago, and that was a strong scene. I knew it well.
Mm-hmm.
And just in, I feel like in the last 2 years, probably on the back of Chance the Rapper, there just seems to be a tremendous amount of not only great talent that's getting recognized, but I don't know if the right word's industry, but just the support for those artists.
Yeah, I don't think there's I think there's more support within the people than I would say industry, and that's what's more important, that there's fans. There's fans here, like legitimate fans, legitimate supporters out here.
You need it, right?
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, because you were just at Logan Square Art Fest. I talked to her right at the beginning. I mean,
oh, it's
just
beautiful.
Watching the video and people are singing along to your
song.
Oh,
it's crazy.
What's
it's crazy.
What's it feel like to be from Chicago to have that happen on a street festival headlining on a Saturday night?
I'm not used to it at all. I accept it fully. It's so awesome. It feels so great to, like, to, you know, to sit in a room and make these songs and if you look at these songs online, they don't have millions of plays, you know what I mean? Like, people are listening, but it's not like ultra mega hits. And so I don't know people are going to come out and, you know, and be knowing these songs and just to watch people sing along with songs that haven't even been out a year. It's just, man, it's so cool.
That's great.
I do not take it for granted. So come to the Taste of Chicago July 5th. You will have the most positive experience of your life. I will guarantee that. It will be the most positive, fun experience of your life. Come see this set at the Taste of Chicago. It's an hour long. It's me for an hour long. If you can withstand this for an hour, come on out. It's going to be wild. Hopefully, I can get some circus performers there. Hopefully, they don't tax me too much.
There is a circus performer tax.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm going to make it a variety show. This is not just going to be me rapping for 60 minutes. This is going to be, I'm telling you, Chicago, listen, this is going to be insane. Someone's going to be flying in from a chopper. Someone's going to be rising from under the stage. I don't know who yet. I haven't assigned the positions yet, but
it might be
a Backstreet Boy or two. The budget's a little bit bigger for this show than usual, so we're going to shell out. We